Hey guys, Chris here, and before I take you into the Q&A proper, I just wanted to briefly come in and mention something about this episode. So right before we start getting into the Q&A proper, I bring up a tangent discussing Linkin Park's newest album, One More Light, that came out earlier this year. I'm pretty negative towards it. I was not a fan of the album at all, and I wanted to point out, it might be obvious, but this discussion happened all entirely before the news came out about Chester Bennington, the lead singer of Linkin Park, committing suicide. I want to stress that, you know, we didn't do this to be insensitive to him, to the band, to anyone listening who's a huge fan of Linkin Park. Nick and myself are both huge fans of the band. I don't speak for Nick on this, but I would easily be able to say Linkin Park was maybe the defining band of my teenage years. I have a lot of respect for them, and I did not intend this to be something that comes across as insensitive or rude or anything like that. I didn't want to take it out because I still feel there's a value to it. But I understand if some people think it's just uncomfortable to listen to or anything like that. It's perfectly understandable. If it's something you don't want to hear, when it pops up, and you'll know when it comes up, just skip ahead about 5 minutes, and that's when we get into the Q&A proper itself. But outside of that, guys, I just want to note, it's a very unfortunate situation and happened, just in the confines of this. Obviously, there's far more regarding the whole situation in general, but, there was no intended slight on our behalf to make a mockery of the situation that happened. It was purely just very unfortunate timing, with the way things happened. But regardless, I hope you can still enjoy the episode, still have fun, and I will throw it over to Nick now, who I'm going to toss it to as though he knows that I'm going to, but he's not. So here you go, Nick. Nice haircut.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap. It is the Q&A episode for July of 2017 with Nick and Chris. How you doing there?
I'm Chris, and I'm doing well. I am a little bit writing a sad note, though, because I don't know if you follow me on Twitter, Nick. But yesterday I posted how I reached a hipster zenith by picking up chai-flavored cola at the store. And I was super pumped for it, and it turned out to just basically taste like flat Coke. And
oh, good.
I'm pretty bummed by that. I really became deflated. My entire world feels like it's untrue now or something.
Flat Coke is awful. I mean, it's just terrible.
It's awful, yeah. And maybe that's what this would just, like, maybe I should have thought that. I don't know. I already love chai lattes. Why did I think something else chai, like, I needed this in my life? Especially since I don't drink Coke, but, or, like, soda anymore. But, I still have three more of these, and even this one, which is 80% full, to just sit here and taunt me with. Like, hey, you spent money on me, and I'm awful. So I'm trying to recover from that.
You did this to yourself.
Yeah.
Don't blame me just because I offered you wonderful things and then didn't deliver.
If Hitchcock were still alive, he'd write a story about this, basically. Or Poe. Like, this would be like a Telltale Heart kind of scenario. Like, every day, like, night I wake up and I'm just like, it sounds like bottles are clicking in my living room. And I walk in there and it's just the three-pack of cola left over. Like, drink us! I'm like, no! You shouldn't control me!
You know the trailer for Psycho? That it's basically just like Hitchcock leading the cameraman on like a tour through the house.
Really?
Yeah, like a tour through the hotel where the movie takes place, and you just like showing them around, and you know he looks like inside one door and it's like, oh, I dare not show you in there. Just imagine, like, inside his head, he's thinking, that's where Christopher Larios had the chai soda.
That's where the chai soda haunts one Harrisburgian was every days. I'm like, Henry Kissinger, why are you here? I'm many places.
I show up in a lot of things.
I'm wherever there's turmoil and tragedy so that I may be able to add my input. You're fucked. Makes me laugh. Hey, we got some questions, Nick, and we also have some answers.
And some answers, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So every month we do this, we pose a question to you guys, and then the next month we read out some of our favorite answers that we got. So I actually have those compiled. And last month we put out, I guess not actually a question, but more of a call for an answer of some kind. It wasn't posed as a question, unless the question was, give us your manga hot takes, I guess. So we asked for your manga hot takes. And if you don't know what those are, essentially hot takes, just a very unpopular opinion that you might have on something. So we got plenty of these. And I'm actually going to start this one with very short and succinct. This is from CVFPO, excuse me, who says, I think Haikyuu is overrated and the art is messy. And that's it. Hey!
That's a good hot take.
It is. I got one here from Michael Hurt, actually. He actually posed two, but I'm using this one here because this is actually an example of one where he has the unpopular opinion that something is better than a lot of people think. He says, sure. I actually think One Piece has gotten better since the time skip in terms of sheer enjoyment and being invested every week in where the story and overall plot is going. I think unlike most other time skips where the story feels a lot weaker and less focused or connected on what happened previously, One Piece's overall storytelling has gotten much better, and I felt like Oda has really stepped it up. Feels like all the arcs and character points feel a lot more thought out than what we've gotten before, and that's not something I feel anyone else is even talking about. So, that's a hot take that someone thinks something's better than what a lot of people are saying.
That's a good one, yeah.
Jack Lebrano hits hard, because he says, my hot take on manga is that the fourth part of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure is incredibly overrated. Although it does have a fun protagonist, a great villain, and a few good characters, not make up for the fact that it has the worst plot progression out of the series, introduces a lot of characters that literally do nothing, with many of them in the main plot, and has some of the worst feeling of female characters I've seen in the series, with the exception of one who starts off dead. And despite what everyone is saying that it's one big mystery, there are zero reveals because the audience always knows who the culprit is. So, I can absolutely see that. And I usually tend to, like, emphasize part four as being, like, my favorite and build it up to be the best.
But right.
I should always, I guess, emphasize more that that is just a personal opinion of mine because it just hits my particular taste a little bit more than some of the others. But I can see it, especially because there's a lot of people after the fourth part came out and Arakai himself says fourth is his favorite part. I can see how people would be led to believe, like, it has to be the outright best part, period. And that's not going to be the case. One last one here. This is from Winter Seaport. It says, I feel like I'm alone in my deep dislike of Jiraiya from Naruto. The various sexy jutsus and porn reading habits shared amongst the cast were actually pretty funny, but I've never found Jiraiya's blatant invasion of privacy as anything other than horrifying. Peeking into women's baths and apparently is an age-old comedy trope in Japan, but I still cringe every time I see an anime and manga. Mineta from My Hero Academia is just as gross, and I'm thankful he has a small English fan base. Stepping on my soapbox for a moment, I take a lot of issue with Jiraiya's portrayal as a wandering sage looking for peace in a war-torn world. This had a lot of potential to be an interesting storyline, but we never get to see him truly be this wise neutral party wandering the continent, trying to make things better for everyone, or empathizing with the troubles of others for the sake of peace. Jiraiya was prophesized to teach someone to be either the savior or destroyer, and given all the dull, miserable slog this manga became in the end, maybe Naruto was the destroyer after all. The destroyer of our enjoyment.
Wow.
Yeah, there's actually several parts of that I cut out.
That's a real hot take. That's good. That's not just like, I think this is good or bad. There is history analysis there. There is contextual analysis. There is character study. I'm going way back into the history of the character, too. Like, I mean, how well do you even remember that arc where they go and find Tsunade, for example?
Yeah, it's been a long time. And there's actually a lot of that Winter Seaport wrote that I just cut out.
Over a decade easily at this point.
Yeah, Winter Seaport made a lot of good points. It is interesting. I suppose...
Because he first showed up in the Chunin exam, didn't he? In order to teach Naruto. He helped out with Naruto's seal and stuff, so... Gosh, he's been around since probably around 2000, 2001. Such a long time to just know that character. So, yeah, a lot of the details have really faded into the background for me.
Yeah. It's a really interesting point. I like this question a lot, or these answers a lot. It was interesting to see some people's thoughts on their unpopular opinions about manga. So,
and, you know, you can't ask someone for their hot takes and then expect there to be things that you don't disagree with. Fuck's sake!
No, I mean, that's the point. Like, these are hot takes. It means that it's not about people saying, well, I hate Fairy Tail because it's stupid. And it's like, I think a lot of people would agree with that. Hot takes mean something you think that is very unpopular as a whole, especially in, like, the communities you're a part of. So a lot of the unpopular opinions we got are kind of ones directed at sort of the opinions we've brought into the show and kind of our shared amongst the community. Like, I don't know if the grand majority of One Piece fans as a whole think that One Piece got worse after the time skip. But it's certainly a sentiment that's kind of been shared amongst our show. At least I've had that. So a lot of these were kind of ones directed at us, and I like seeing the different opinions on that. There's no right or wrong opinion on this sort of stuff, and that's important. It's also going to be important in the question I'm going to be asking you guys for this month. So my question this time is, what are some of your favorite themes explored in a manga? And this can be, again, there's no right or wrong answer on this. So there could be any kind of range that you want to go with on this. And if you're not really sure what you mean, literary themes essentially is what we're going for. What are some of your ones that you find really interesting? You don't have to, you don't think you have to overthink this and come up with some very complex answer or something like that. It could be anything like, I love the way One Piece explores the theme of dreams and motivation, you know, or I love the way that, Food Wars explores the theme of, creativity or something like that. For example, one I love is, 20th Century Boys. I love how it explores the themes of childhood and how it, like, details what we do as kids and their ramifications later on. Just stuff like that. Give us some of your favorite themes in manga and we'll love to read those out next month on the show.
So,
yeah. And then we do a question for each other.
Yes. This is going to be a kind of a very open question. I guess, while reading manga, Chris,
okay,
has there ever something come up that you've seen and you're like, I want that in real life? For example, it could be a dish in Food Wars. They're like, I need this in my mouth. It could be, I don't know, a comfy looking home. Or that you want to live in, anything like that.
Could be some kind of sexy lady that I would like the companionship of.
Sure, even that.
Okay. In that way, I would like Omori from Gyakko the Galactic Patrolman to come to life
through this call
and be my grandpa
and punch you in the face
because I wanted to get and I can beat it. I've definitely had it with Food Wars, where I've had certain dishes come up that I'm like, oh, that seems so good. Like the roast they did in the first one where it was like a potato roast wrapped up in bacon to like resemble meat it's like something that I'm like, oh, that seems so good. But I think even more than that, I remember when Toriko did the Regal Mammoth arc and they showed Jewel Meat. I don't think I've ever felt hungrier reading a manga than I did at that point where I was just like, oh my God. Like it was just the way like all the juices are drawn, everything like that. I was like, God, I want this. Like nobody's freaking business. But outside of that, you know, I'm not much of like a collector of things. Like I don't buy like props or something like that from series I like, but I think I always thought it would be cool to own like the sword Zoro uses in One Piece. Like at least like what's the one that's like kind of reverse color? That's the newest one I think he has. Where like the blade itself is black. That, I forget, it's the cursed one I think he got from Ryuma. Or not the cursed one from Ryuma. It's the one he got from Ryuma.
Are you talking about the one he got from the samurai?
Yeah, from Ryuma.
Right.
I forget the name of it. It's the one though where, the actual blade itself is like black, essentially. And, I always thought that was a really cool, like, kind of, color scheme and everything like that. So I definitely would be like, oh, that's pretty dope using that. You know, at least in my mind. Mieto is the sword. Mieto was the quality of the sword. Shushui was the sword. And it was an entirely black sword with like a black edge to it. Super cool. What about yourself?
I have wanted many things in the Food Wars. One of the early dishes, the transforming rice, that someone made where like the meat melts into the rice as it's dumped in.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good example. In terms of like, places, I've always thought that actually like just in general, the, world of, Food War surround, not Food War, sorry, World Trigger, surrounding border would be really cool. It'd be really nice to have, you know, an interesting job with stable employment, even if it were regularly invaded by neighbors. And in all other respects, it seems as though the town that they're in is just normal. So that would be cool.
It is interesting because it's sort of that logic that you almost have to put into like superhero comic books where you're just like, I mean, like with Gotham City constantly being under siege by Batman's villains, why would anyone still live in Gotham? And that's sort of the same thing with the border, but they actually kind of explain it like, yeah, but they have like a designated zone where the portals generally appear, and because you're that close to border, that means that their response time is to you is going to be the quickest. Like, it makes sense for why people would still live near border, whereas Gotham always like, just leave. Just get out of this awful, awful city.
The only thing that you can like, imagine with that is that it's just, you know, there's just a bunch of poor people in there. But you would have to think, like, why is there, like, anyone, why is there even an urban center in this city at all? Yeah. Every single time that you throw some sort of big mixer at your company, it's going to be prone to the Joker coming in and kidnapping you in order to get Bruce Wayne's attention or something like that.
Anytime I eat, like, even a hot dog, I'm be like, is this full of laughing gas? And I'm going to just fall to the ground laughing hysterically and just have to hope Batman wins this time again? Or, like, you know, like, I'm going to, like, pass down the street and be like, oh, sorry, ma'am, I accidentally bumped into you. And that's when Poison Ivy's like, ma'am, you men in your world. And suddenly I'm like a flower, like, on top of a building. Like, well, this sucks. I didn't even, like, sexually harass her or anything. Like, I didn't catcall her or something. I said, I'm sorry. I hate this fucking city.
If I knew I was going to end up in this situation anyway, I would have been a way bigger douchebag.
Yeah, I'd have at least gotten something out of it. Come on. Every fucking February the 2nd, I have to watch out for Two-Face's maniacal fucking dealings and nonsense. It's ridiculous. I got a question for you, Nick. It's not nearly as manga-related, though, unfortunately. I just had kind of a simple question. What is the song that you like for the most part, but you can't enjoy because you hate one part of it really bad?
That's a very good question.
This came to me recently because I was listening to the song White Wedding by, I think, Billy Idol is the one who does it.
Yes.
Billy Idol. And I love that song. Like, it's got such a great beat to it. It's got such a great hook. But I can't stand the ending. And I'm like, I want to buy this song to have it on my iPod. But I know
kind of like structure of the song just sort of breaks down.
Yeah, and it takes a long time to end. And I'm like, if I'm going to be listening to this while, like, I'm in the car or I'm, like, doing a run or something.
Take It Back Home, yeah, or something like that. And he says it, like, 20 times or something like that.
Yeah, and I'm just like, I just don't want to deal with that part. Every time it comes up, I'm going to immediately be like, well, now I want to skip the song. And it's like, why have the song on my iPod then if I'm going to, like, constantly when it comes up, I'm going to have the urge to skip over a portion of it.
Sure. There's actually a song in the same vein that I dislike for the exact same reason, which is Layla. The Eric Clapton song, you know, You Got Me on My Knees, Layla. It's an awesome guitar-centric song, but then for, like, the last 2 or 3 minutes of a 6-minute song, it's just, like, not completely unlike the rest of it. It slows down, and it takes forever to end. It's got this awesome guitar riff to it. It's one of the classics. It's one of the examples you point to if you want to say like, oh, you know, Eric Clapton's a great guitarist. And then it just takes forever before you finish listening to it. For the opposite reason, I actually don't like Stairway to Heaven.
Really? Just takes too long to start?
Takes too fucking long to start. When it finally does, it's amazing. But it takes like 5 minutes to get there. I'm not this patient, okay? If I'm going to listen to a song, I want to listen to it from beginning to end, basically. Or at the it's better if it ends poorly because then, you know, you can hit skip at the end as opposed to, okay, the song has started. Let me just drag the frickin' thing past the first several minutes of introductions.
I have that exact same issue with the one from Metallica where it's just like, look, this is like Blue Balls, the intro where you're just like, you're waiting for the song to start. Every time it's like, it's like 3 minutes of a guitar intro where you're just like, come on.
I think that sounds cooler, but I definitely understand that, especially because it sounds so different from the ending of the song where it's going,
all I see, absolute horror, all I feel, I cannot see. Yeah, like, it's just like, it's such a slow, like, thing to get to that point where you're just like, come on.
Even if you, you know, start off slow with the, you know, like, I guess, make the intro, I guess, 1 minute, or even just like one repetition of the strumming, and then it goes into the vocals, and then it builds up to the turn to death and landmines and stuff. More like breaking it down to elements as opposed to parts of the runtime, There are a few songs where I've liked parts, but you know, for example, if I like the melody or I don't like, but I don't like the vocals. The most recent example, and I'm not sure if this is the best one or if you'll even know what I'm talking about. Do you know who Aleister Black is?
Yeah, from WWE, NXT.
People love his theme song.
I hate it. I listen to wrestling
like
themes consistently, and when WWE uploaded that one, I was like, this sucks.
I don't like the vocals, basically. I think that I really feel as though there's something just missing from it. You know, I think it's got a great intro with the, you know, but as soon as that singer comes in, it's like, why are you listening to this song? Okay.
Yeah. Before we get into the actual questions we'll be answering from everybody then, I just want to note, since I've been doing a lot of studying recently, schoolwork and everything like that, I've been playing a lot of, like, playlists on Spotify just to, like, give me something to listen to. So, but after running through my usual collection, I was like, let me try branching out into a couple things. And I was like, let me go check out what Linkin Park's been up to. And I guess I've missed, like, 3 Linkin Park albums. And for the most part,
a lot of people have kind of dropped off whenever they did the one that was about atomic warfare and stuff.
I listened to Minutes to Midnight. I bought that when it originally came out. And that was when that was like their first album after like 6 years or something like that. After Meteoria,
yeah,
they had taken
a long
break. And I remember being like, it's just not the same thing, but I was okay with it. Like at the time, there were a couple songs I liked. And now I listen to it. I'm like, this is actually a pretty strong album. And I've been going through a couple. I don't know when this one came out. There's one relatively new one that is horrendous. It is fucking a travesty. Let me see if I can find the name for this, because first and foremost, if you told me it was Linkin Park who sang it, I would call you a liar. I'd be like, there's no way. This is like pop garbage, like the softest music. One More Light, it's called. It came out this year. It is unlistenable. It is horrendous. I like pop music in general, and this is still just terrible. And knowing Linkin Park was the one who did it is just heartbreaking, where you're just like, what happened? Like, when did it, like, reach this point where, like, I guess we aren't relevant anymore. They're still making Transformer movies, but we're not doing the songs for them anymore. I guess let's try to move mainstream or so. I don't know. It's just, it is awful. All kinds of awful. Make yourself sad and listen to it.
Okay, then.
There. All right, let's get into our Q&A. So,
all right.
I'll start us off here. We're into March right now, guys, so hopefully we'll see what we get from this. First question here is from Jack I Am Apollo 11 Lebrano, who says, Dear Dr. Love Person and Professor Smart Pants.
Many ellipses, pants.
Many ellipses. A reference to a joke I think we did at the end of the Q&A probably like 4 months ago or something like that.
Probably.
I do know the reference. I think that was at the end of an episode. And I think that was supposed to be our handles if we started doing like a relationship or life advice podcast.
Right, yeah.
Jack asks, I've been introduced to my girlfriend at Joe's Bizarre Adventure, and we're at Battle Tendency, and she's seeing all the weird stuff going on. So in that vein, Chris, and Nick too if he wants, what do you think is the weirdest thing you've come across when experiencing JoJo for the first time?
Probably managed child or managed baby.
Oh, the
that was a
really
weird one. Death 13.
Death 13, that was it. I was trying to remember the name of the tarot card. Yeah, Death 13. That is it for me in a different way. I remember one of the things that actually turned me off of JoJo when I initially was reading it was the violence in it, like how like graphic it was. And I remember like I think it's the scene where Kakyon is introduced. He like stabs a nurse in the eye with a pen. You see it very like visually, like ugh.
Uh-huh.
And that scene in Death 13 with the dog, when like they wake up after a dog got like hit with a scythe in the dream world, and they see the results of that, was like, oh my god,
with its eye hanging out and stuff.
Yeah, it pulls no punches on that, so I could definitely see that. Weirdest thing though, man, that's tough. There's so many weird moments in JoJo. I feel like one of them has to be in part 7 when you find out, like, not only is it like, hey, it's a race across the United States, also we have to find the corpse of Jesus Christ along the way and gain its magic power. And you're like...
Okay, then.
You're like, what?
Yeah.
And that is a legit... That's, like, the plot of Part 7.
You know, finding the magical corpse of Jesus Christ, that's a trope in manga as old as time.
I'm yes.
Like, come on.
And it's always in America, obviously, where Jesus died.
Turns out the Book of Mormon was completely accurate.
It was spot on with that shit. So, I think that's maybe what I'd call to.
The reason why you know that the Shroud of Turin wasn't really the thing that they buried Jesus in was because they didn't find it in America.
It didn't have an American flag on it, so they were like, this can't be right.
It was buried in an American flag thousands of years before America was founded.
With like the big, like fucking Uncle Sam hat with like a sparkler in his hand that doesn't go out.
No, they actually did find him an American flag, but you know, it's not real because there were only 48 stars.
Yeah, this nonsense. It's somehow still buried watching the fourth season of Friends. It's very strange.
Oh, God.
All right. Thank you for the question, dude, Jack. That was a good question.
All right. This next one comes from Andre Golden. Dear why the ruler of Super Sentai and Power Rangers T. I have to say thank you for the Q&A because they helped me deal with my sadness and growing feeling of apathy of life.
Hey.
And now for my questions.
Hey, take care of yourself. Make sure you, if you're starting to worry about yourself, make sure you, go see somebody about that. Legitimately, It may be something that you just need to get treatment for. And it's in the same way of saying, like, if I have poor vision, you're not going to help yourself by saying, well, I don't want glasses. You can get glasses. It'll help you out a lot more. So take care
Indeed.
Of yourself.
Yes. We have to.
Yep.
By the time you're reading this, the Power Rangers movie has come out. And so here are some power questions. I heard that movie was okay.
I've heard it's really good, but I can't think of, I didn't see it yet. And I really want to. It's just one of those things I keep forgetting to like go out and find it, basically.
It was one of those cases where, like, I saw the trailer for it, and I was like, are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah.
Oh, man, it's come to this. And then people said that, I was like, oh, well, okay then. You know? It's one of those things where it's like, with few exceptions, I don't want things to actually be bad.
Yeah, like, I legitimately was like, super excited for a Power Rangers movie upon hearing, like, a lot of the casting stuff, like, Bryan Cranston's Zordon. I'm like, oh, okay, like, I can get behind this.
Mm-hmm.
And then seeing the trailer, it's like, oh, well, this is just going to be awful. And then hearing from a bunch of people, they're like, actually, it's not that bad. I'm like, especially I've heard people say that the high school parts are fantastic. They're like, it's like legitimately like a new Breakfast Club kind of thing. You're like, what?
People have said that the portrayal of autism is actually really good.
It's the first openly, homosexual superhero in any movie. When you consider all the Marvel and all the DC movies throughout everything, this is the first time in a Power Rangers movie there's been an openly LGBT. You know the fucking acronym I'm trying to
use. LGBTQ.
I'm bad with them. An openly that character, and I'm bad with acronyms.
Which, I mean, when you consider the fact that it took so long to get one where it was centered around a female protagonist. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess the Blade movies, but like otherwise you're like, we're still kind of waiting for like a black superhero who's the lead of his own movie.
Yeah,
we're waiting
for that Black Panther movie, basically. I mean, there were some, and before people start throwing out examples, yes, obviously there were superhero movies in, you know, the early 2000s and in the 90s and so on where you could say like, oh, well, there was this and this, but in the superhero boom.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
And yes, Power Rangers is a superhero movie. It's just a different type of superhero movie. Anyway, on to the actual questions that Andre has. Number one, what is your favorite Megazord? This answer has changed for me a number of different times, but I am going to say the Astro Megazord from In Space. I just like the... I know that some people will say, like, oh, but it's not five, the combined one. No, but I like the blue and sleek look to it.
This is tough for me, because I honestly, at first, like, thought, I was like, I don't know if I have one, per se. Mm-hmm. Part of me, I kind of wants to go to, like, the SPD Zord, But they had like fucking five different versions of it eventually, so I don't know if I really
have. There are a few seasons where it's just like that, where there's, yeah, a billion different, Megazords that they end up getting because, I don't know, that Sentai line had a bunch of toys.
You know what? I'm gonna do my own hot take here. And I'm gonna reveal myself to be a little bit of a robot racist. I can't tell the difference between most of the Megazords. They all look the same to me. They're all big robots. They're all big robots with colorful parts that the bunch you die, and that's it. Like, they don't really have that big of a special, connection for me.
If we're including the Sixth Ranger Megazords as well, then my answer would be different too. There are a fair few that I really, really like. The Dragonzord's really cool. The Mega Winger, also from Min Space, is really cool. What was it called? I forget what the Magna Defender Zord was called, but I liked the fact that he just grew big and rode a giant bull around in its first form.
I'm gonna go out on a limb. Is it called the Magna Zord?
It could very well be. Let me look it up. Hang on. You read the second part of the question while I look this up.
Yeah, so the second question is, what season do we think has the best outfits? Also, I feel sad because I read the PS, which says, I hope you'd be reading this by March or April and not June. Well, we're not reading it by June, reading it after June. which season has the best outfits? So I assume that would mean the actual Ranger outfits. Because there are some seasons where, like SPD, where they actually get the out-of-character characters have uniforms and things like that.
That is true. Lightspeed Rescue had that.
Space had it.
Space had the jackets, yes.
There are a couple there. But going with the actual, like, the Ranger uniform, it's hard not to just immediately say, like, Mighty Morphin. Because Mighty Morphin had such a great outfit. Mm. Very predominant emphasis of, like, their color scheme. The helmets all, like, had that animalistic feel to them. The boots and gloves all, like, you know, they added a cool contrast. The diamond pattern was kind of cool. I also liked SPD a lot. I thought, like, the way it, like, gave them all numbers was kind of cool, though in a way it very easily, like, degraded the Pink Ranger to the bottom fucking member on the list. It's actually kind of...
You're number five!
It's kind of fucked up at the time, because she has that outfit when they hadn't decided on a 1 or a 4. I kind of got the 1. Like, you're like, we just don't have a leader yet, and Sky hasn't been promoted yet. So it's like, okay, that's why he's 2 and 3. But there hasn't been a 4 introduced yet. Why is she the 5th? Like, that's so fucked up.
We don't know who's going to be number 4, but you are definitely the least important member of this team.
Yeah. We haven't decided.
You are definitely last in command.
Like, we haven't decided on who will be the leader, but we're sure somebody else is going to come along who's going to be better than you, fucking pink girl. It's like,
When you consider, like, the importance that's been placed on some of the Pink Rangers in the past, like, Jen in Time Force was, was basically the leader of that team.
Yeah.
Kimberly was really popular in the original. Yeah, for them to just be like, the pink one's the least important.
Like,
out of the 3 members we have, you are the 5th.
It made sense in the notion of, like, the hierarchy of the show and everything like that. It's probably something where, I don't know if in the Japanese Sentai though, it started on that idea that there were 3 and 2 more came along and got their numbers assigned. Like, it just feels really fucked up in the American the beginning where you're just like, why is she 5th when there's only 3?
Oh, man.
But yeah, SPD I like a lot, and Dino Thunder was part of my favorites.
I really like the look of the helmets for Time Force, but not so much the rest of it. Mm-hmm. I actually thought that the samurai looked cool. I mean, just like the way that it looks like, you know, an actual like samurai robe.
Yeah.
And when I first was looking into questions for this, I was like, I need to actually like see like these in order to give myself a good answer. And the newest Power Rangers season, Ninja Steel, I think the uniforms look fucking amazing. So that's a good one too.
Let me see. I don't think I've seen Ninja Steel's outfits. Ninja Steel.
With like this, sash that goes on.
Kind of gives me like a Mortal Kombat vibe when you kind of see it a little bit, where just like the color coded ninja kind of thing looks pretty dope. What was, Mega Force, I think was the version they did? That was the pirate version?
With the pirates.
I do actually like the original pirate one a little bit. where it's like the coat is their color and the rest is like kind of a black
outfit. I just like how they it's we're doing pirates for this one. What should we call it? Mega Force.
Well, I don't. Did they build on the? Because that was the theme in the Sentai. I wonder, and it was also their legacy one where they kept bringing in old Rangers. So I don't.
Right. So I guess that the reason for it was because they could use it to call upon the powers of the past Rangers. Yeah.
So they probably were just like, all right, so we'll slide this guy. Like we'll make it, well, you know, we'll use the pirate part, and you know, we can't ignore that. But we're making the focus of the season on the idea that like they're gonna be channeling old Rangers and shit like that. I don't know. But I think that was Super Mega Force where they started doing that. I think Mega the Mega Force was just the pirate one, and they were just like, look, we're getting to that end goal, alright? We're not calling this fucking pirate adventure or whatever, alright? That fucking Pirates of the Caribbean shit is over.
I mean, though, it was actually, they were actually called, like, Pirate Rangers in the original Japanese, though. So.
Yeah, that's, because that, I think that did come out when Pirates of the Caribbean was a huge thing. I think it was around that same time, plus One Piece being over there as big as it was. Made sense for a pirate theme season, but over here, you're eventually just
done like, a billion samurai and car and ninja, fucking pirates.
Yeah, they're like, we have like four dinosaur seasons and shit. There's a couple different seasons with trains, alright? Let's just do pirates once. America was like, fuck this noise.
Oh god, another emergency vehicle season. Ugh.
Harumph. How many times could somebody be in an ambulance? That'd be cool.
What happens? This is what happens when you do a series for 30 years and have to come up with a new aesthetic every single season.
Yeah. But no, those are really cool ones out there.
And the last part of the question is favorite villain from Power Rangers. I don't think that you can't go wrong with Rita and Zed.
Yeah, I was gonna say Zed because I remember. Do you remember when he got introduced and it was like a season finale terrifying. Or something like that? And he shows up and just beats the Rangers and it ends with him destroying their Zords and they're just like looking on as their Zords just crumble to pieces in front of them and you're like, holy shit, Zed is terrifying. He also introduced like stronger putties, which for some reason their weakness was the big Z shaped like fucking imprint on their belly that like, was the source of their strength. But if you just hit that, they died. I was like, well, that seems weird to put that weakness on them.
Do you remember the short Alien Rangers season where the Rangers were turned into kids and then they had to go and find the Zeo crystals while the Alien Rangers did it? There was an episode where a group of putties went after the kids and they literally just had been like playing soccer. So they threw the soccer ball at the putties' chest and beat them.
That's so sad.
A group of kids did that.
Oh, that's so sad.
Ah, curse you, little rangers. Why didn't I just send a regular monster after you?
Fuck, what was the name of... I'm trying to remember the name of the villain, too, that I really liked. It was the one from Time Force, I think it was, where it was like a human guy with like... He had like the Kano, yeah, where like yeah, half yeah. of his body's like cyborg and shit.
Yeah.
He was really cool, too. I probably...
Rancid.
Rancid. I was like, it's probably some stupid name like Mutinous or something like that. Or
Rancid's a much better name than that. Give him some credits.
Yeah, oh yeah. That actually is a pretty impressive one, grand scheme of things.
I really like Rancid and his group. I also looking back, I really like the group of villains in Space 2. Astronema was like the first time that they really did, a corrupted good guy is the villain. And I think the time that they probably did it best. Ecliptor, I think, is a really cool kind of Shades of Grey, villain that, they, have done, managed to do effectively every now and again, where they're a bad person, but they've got their own code and way of doing things and people that they actually genuinely care about, so that they stay a villain all throughout, but you do kind of sympathize with some of the stuff that they do. And then on the other side of that, they had, Dark Honda, who's just an asshole, so.
just a big dickhead.
But in general, I do really like the original group of villains that they had, you know, Rita, just in terms of like pure entertainment value, Rita and her goons are probably the funniest and most entertaining set that they've had.
It's easy for us to like remember them, like
Squat Babu,
Goldar, Finster. Yeah. Like it's they're iconic at this point. Mm-hmm. All right,
okay,
that's good questions. I got to reminisce on Power Rangers for a bit. Questions here from Shockwave. Says, hey, Chris, the only more disappointing NFL team is the Cleveland Browns who couldn't go 0-16. And Nick, what the hell is a Link Summon? Sorry to start off serious, but this one is something bugging me since watching all JoJo's this past week. How does JoJo's Star Platinum have the world power? Did he just kind of absorb part of it from Dio, or was it something else? So this is a good question, and it's something that I don't know has ever been, like, adequately kind of explained in the JoJo series. I originally thought it was meant to be that the world was kind of hereditary power of the Joestars, and the reason Dio had it was because he took Jonathan's body. But they actually have explained later on that the world is Dio's stand. It's not because he has Jonathan's body. Mm-hmm. And the implication you kind of are meant to get from the anime is, and it probably might have been dialogue taken directly from the manga, is that Jotaro and Dio just have very similar stands, because they note that they're both stands with very short range that are very fast, very powerful, and very accurate, and that's kind of where they're at. And to that point, that's all that Jotaro thought his stand was until he finds out, hey, Dio's can stop time. I wonder if mine can too. And that's how he proves himself kind of right on that. He finds out he can stop time as well or exist in that thing. So it is something where that would actually make a lot of logical sense, but it is harder to recognize and even fully accept that as an answer because this isn't something that comes up later on. You never find more people who are like, oh, we have very similar stands or our stands are the same type. Like, that's not a thing people generally say or use in the series at any point in time. So that's the explanation as to how I understand it. They just had very similar stands and that's why Jotaro's was able to do that. But outside of that, it never comes up again in the series, so who knows.
And I just kind of assumed that it was a matter of, like, Jotaro just kind of getting used to it because Dio kept on using it on him. And so that combined with the fact that, yeah, he had a stand that allowed him to be super fast, it's, you know, when you think about it, although the world is completely stopping time, it is a way of moving very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was kind of a combination of those things that allowed him to just kind of get used to it eventually and overcome the effect it was having on him.
Yeah. And that's, I think, kind of a little bit of where we're supposed to get from it. It also made sense, too, or helped later on when you, like, look back on all the JoJos and their powers. You're like, man, if fucking Star Platinum couldn't stop time, it'd be the worst stand. It's so boring. It's just, like, really punches hard and is, like, a small range.
Really fast.
I was like, because they explained later on, I think they mentioned that Josuke's stand in Part 4 is actually stronger physically than Jotaro's stand, where you're like, oh, man, this actually has a cool power, too. So I guess it helps in the long run by being at least like, well, he has that too. So there, you know what? Maybe there is a connection based on the tarot. Despite this season, the Dice Funk actually dealing very heavily with tarotism, I have no idea how a lot of it works. There may be a connection between the star and the world. I don't know. So maybe it applies into that.
Mm.
Next question here. Question 2. Don Kanoji versus Mr. Satan. Who would win the Lucky Bastard tournament?
Mr. Satan.
That could be that might be interesting. I think we would be in for an amazing showcase, certainly. They're both showmen, so you'd have that. Yeah, I want to say Mr. Satan, it's tough.
Don Kanoji has actual powers, but if you look at their actual repertoire, Don Kanoji beat Minor Hollows, and Mr. Satan helped to turn Majin Buu good and save the world from Kid Buu. So,
but that was his personality.
Final. That doesn't matter. It's not a matter of who's stronger. It's who is the Lucky Bastard tournament.
Oh, okay. Yeah, then you gotta do that. Yeah, it would be Mr. Satan. All right, question 3. It's time for a Shonen Jump cookie contest. Sanji versus Komatsu versus Soma versus Lunch Rush. Who would win and how would they? I don't even know who Lunch Rush is. Lunch Rush manga? Lunch Rush is a place in My Hero Academia. Oh, I guess it's like a cooking establishment with like superhero servers. People use their powers.
Okay.
It was introduced in My Hero Academia 7.
Is a lunchman and pro hero at UA.
Oh, okay. Lunch Rush.
Where's cooking internet?
Okay. So Lunch Rush is the place and there's a hero there too. Well, Lunch Rust doesn't win because I don't know who the fuck he is. He loses just people. I think the answer kind of always is going to be Komatsu, just based on the notion that he actually is magically meant to be the best chef, kind of. Like, he knows how to, like, cook food the best way. I guess if you took that power...
He can hear the voice of ingredients. He's invented new methods of actually cooking stuff.
Yeah, like, the notion was supposed to be that, like, ingredients are calling out to him because he's that in tune with them and create perfect dishes based on that. So, I'd say Komatsu. Right. Since Yu-Gi-Oh's offer was inspired by Johto to agree, what stands would the original cast of Yu-Gi-Oh have? Man, you know what? It's actually an interesting question because, like, original Yugi or Yami, when he's a fucking serial killer who just, like, finds people he doesn't like and puts them in these weird games, that would actually be something where a stand would fit in really well. Like, once it moves to, like, card games and things like that, it makes a lot less sense because unless you're just all Star Platinum and using them to cheat, like, it doesn't really play that much. But you could actually put, like, a stand into the way, like, he does a thing like, oh, you know, we can only use one figure and I'm going to put my my lighter on my thumb or something like that or whatever. So you could apply it in there. Otherwise, I don't really... as I say, they all take Star Platinum so they could cheat. Sorry, I don't have a better answer than that, but I don't know. What else would fucking Joey use a stand for? Or kind of.
I don't know. For example, like Pegasus, you know, had the Millennium Eye. So, is there some sort of stand that would, effectively mimic that, like, in terms of mind reading?
There are stands that do similar concepts. Nothing, like, outright, though. I just know what you're thinking. They're usually, like, even more powerful and things like that. There's one that lets you, like, relive experiences that happen in a certain area, so maybe, like, Ishizu would want that as an archaeologist, or as, like, a historian kind of thing. There's no... Fuck it.
What about Johnny Steps, Chris? What about Johnny Steps? Come on.
Johnny Steps? Who's Johnny Steps?
He's this one asshole dancer character who harassed Taya in, like, one filler episode.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I was going to say, Taya would have Spice Girls because she's a worthless character in much of the series, but in the same way Trish is in Part 5. So it would only be fitting if she has her stand, which comes out of nowhere and then just doesn't really have relevant point later on.
What stand does Serenity have, Chris? This is the kind of stuff that we need to answer.
You know, there's just not enough friendship stands to spread across the cast of Yu-Gi-Oh, unfortunately.
What about Panic, the guy who used Castle of Dark Illusions and thought that, you know, hiding behind a shield would let him win?
He can have Vanilla Ice's stand, Cream, which murders you, basically. we're gonna give him some crazy, stupid, powerful stand. Question 5 here. Deku's training or Saitama's? Which would you rather do?
I would rather go for Saitama's because although it's pretty normal until you get to 10 kilometers running. But the rest of it is just like, you know, 100 squats a day, 100 pushups a day, 100 sit-ups a day. That's all stuff that's like, okay, you know, whatever. But Deku's is like, spend the entire day clearing out this junkyard.
Yeah. Well, like, yeah, it was 100 sit-ups, 100 squats, 100 pushups, and 10 kilometers running. That's it. I thought there was also something like, with the way he handled his diet.
He also said that you had to, like, one of the things he said was, like, sleep without the air conditioning on, even in the summer, but that's not part of the actual workout, I guess.
I have to assume the whole method is in it. Otherwise, if I'm actually able to do it and attain the results of One Punch Man, and that I'm a comedically broken superhero who can beat anybody in one punch, basically, then yeah, I'm gonna do the one that's basically what I do already, but like, without the air conditioning on. I'm like, fuck that. I'll eventually, once I become a superhero, make enough money that I can buy a house that's like a fucking freezer or something. Like, I don't know. I'll live in fucking Alaska or something.
Okay.
All right. Question 6. Ever want to see Terry Bradshaw try to say Digimon names? For a Patreon review, you guys could watch the Digibowl. You know, if there's a place I could go to just watch the whole entire Digibowl, that might be amusing.
Mm-hmm.
I love just watching, like, regular sports commentators, though, have to engage with nerdy things. It's always fucking fantastic. You know, I've mentioned before when fucking Jerry the King Lawler had to talk about Yu Yu Hakusho, or no, Taz did, and They'd be like, you know, the new Yu Yu Hakusho game, Taz would chime in. Yu Yu Hakusho, I love that guy!
I love this guy!
And just recently at a couple WrestleManias ago, or actually I think it was this one, where the New Day came out as Final Fantasy characters, and Michael Cole had to be like, it's a Chocobo! I love a Chocobo! Or something like that. He's like, he's the Red Mage character from the Final Fantasy games. You're like, God, I love hearing you guys have to talk about shit that you have no clue what it is.
Actually, what I really liked was the fact that the year before they came out, and everyone was like, oh, they're just like Saiyan. They're like, no, Xavier Woods' hair and tail are from a Saiyan, but they're dressed like the fucking Ginyu Force, you plebs.
You don't understand.
They've got the logo on their breastplate, therefore it's the Ginyu Force.
What you don't understand is that Vegeta and Nappa were dressed like that because they were part of the fucking Ginyu Force, or Frieza's army at that point. They all wore that shit.
Right.
Alright, 7. We know Chris's predictions for 2016 mostly came true. Nick, you have to step up your predictions. What are your biggest predictions for 2017?
We were already halfway through the year, so I don't know how much things will matter.
Nick, what are your big predictions for 2017? You got the whole year to put in there. I'm like, well, I'm going to say things are going to come to blow with Mom in One Piece. Jinbei might join the crew. I just use shit that already basically happened. I'm like, Deku.
You won't know this in March. Yeah. You won't know this in March, Andre. Or Matt. Shockwave, sorry. I guess I will actually do one, which is, I think that we'll get an announcement of World Trigger's return by the end of the year.
I'm hoping so. I'm really hoping so. Question 8. How far are you willing to go to a convention if invited?
That depends.
Basically, I think part of that is if the invitation includes, like, the travel expenses or things like that. It's usually the expenses that just is what kind of holds me up. If it's just like, cause it'd be awesome to be invited as a guest to a con. So I think that would be an honor in and of itself. So I'd be willing to like fork out some of my own money just to, you know, fill into that. But you know, if it's something where it's like, hey, yeah, you got to pay for a fucking flight over to Chicago. It's like, that's going to be pretty pricey. really kind of depends on how much is involved. Essentially, distance is actually not that big of an issue for me.
And I think that also the timing of it and various other aspects, I mean, it's not just a matter of distance is the short answer, though.
Yeah. We both have pretty complex schedules at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Last one here. This last question has kept me up at nights. I asked this question in line to meet Jake the Snake, and people nearly killed me without giving an answer, so I have to know. Why do so many people hate John Cena? I mean, I know the arrogance and the ease and everything, but he did throw that YouTube Fred guy through a table in one of the Fred movies. He can't be all bad, right?
John Cena is actually a really cool guy.
John Cena's amazing. Like, John Cena, the person, great. Is one of the thing that you have to understand, wrestling has a lot of big stars, and most of them are shitheads, especially the ones from like the 80s. Like, Hulk Hogan's a dickhead in a lot of ways, whereas John Cena, you're like, this is a dude who is unbelievably nice and like very giving of his time and efforts. So you have to love the person.
Or even people like from a slightly more recent time, like even The Rock, like, you know, who's gone to be this big Hollywood superstar. You'd be like, oh, okay, you know, he's kind of cool. But there are some aspects of what he does where it's just kind of like, okay, we get it. You know, you work out all the time and post on social media. And that seems to be 90% of your life. And occasionally does something cool, but the kind of stuff that Cena does just on the regular, like, all the stuff that he does for the Make-A-Wish Foundation.
He's statistically,
like, 500 people or some shit.
He has granted the most wishes through the Make-A-Wish program than anyone else before.
Not just associated with WWE, anyone who has ever worked with the Make-A-Wish Foundation.
Any
ever.
Musician, any actor, anyone. He's better than, he's surpassed everybody.
And he's super humble about it. Like, he's been given all these awards by them, and every time he gets one, he's just like, you know, I'll say it before I say it again, you know, like, I look forward to doing, like, just as many in the future. Mm-hmm. Like, he's so proud of that. He learned fucking Mandarin Chinese in order to help out the company as they try to expand into the Asian market. He's great. The reason why people hate John Cena is, and even the most stubborn John Cena haters have started to gradually realize this, is that they just hate the way that his character was used on WWE TV. And as he's slowly been taken off of television because he's got more commitments to do and he's, you know, he's trying to start a family and stuff, he's just not showing up as much anymore. the way that he's been used, I think people are much more okay with, because they realize, like, oh, well, he's no longer just the top guy in the company, which is who I direct my hatred to, because he is not the person that I want to be the top guy in the company. That's the reason why people, in general, hate Roman Reigns. There are definitely some problems with Roman Reigns, the way that he is actually written and booked and all that stuff. Same kind of problems that, you know, befell John Cena, even befell, like, people during the Attitude Era. And I think that what you see is that fans of a certain age want the company and want the top people involved in the company to be portrayed a certain way. And if they aren't, if they don't meet that, then they dislike it, and they dislike the fact that they're put in such a prominent position so regularly.
Yeah. You know, there are legitimate reasons to dislike Cena, the wrestler, and those year-long runs he'd have with the title. He did destroy a lot of people who, after losing him, basically just disappeared from the main card scene. He did win a lot of matches in annoying ways. He did, like, you know, it was the whole, the Nexus storyline, the Nexus, where it's he beat the Nexus, took a DDT to the ground.
This was actually something that was Cena's fault.
Yes.
And he admitted, like, that it was a mistake of his, that he shouldn't have done this. Basically, there was this big, team match. There was, like, seven people on a side, with this big new villain group called the Nexus. It was a bunch of upstarts that were new guys in the company. And they had a big 7-on-7 match at, SummerSlam. And they were, the Nexus were originally going to win that match. And Cena said, no, I think that I should win. And it ended up basically destroying the Nexus. And sometime afterwards, he was like, okay, that was a bad idea.
And look, this is primarily not a wrestling podcast, and there's a lot of actual thing to explain within this, where it's like, yeah, you could argue he did that because it's a very competitive world in wrestling, and if you want to keep your top spot, you got to do a lot of politicking to do it, and maybe there's some justification there for things.
Or maybe he just said, I think that this is what people want to see out of this, you know?
Ultimately, the reason people hated John Cena is because he was the top guy in the company for a very long time, did not lose very frequently, and when it did, it was usually some kind of schmoz finish, and he didn't change as a character very often. So people wanted to see something different. They didn't like how he was kind of forced into that role and pushed down everyone's, which is weird because people loved him at the time when he was winning the title. He was incredibly over. That's the reason he got to be world champion in the first place, was because he was so over. Yeah,
there were people who had loved him for basically a year and a half, 2 years before that point, and they were rabidly behind him.
Yeah.
Chris included.
Yeah, I was. I make no bones about it. I was a huge John Cena fan.
With your hollow chain gang padlock. Yep.
Exactly. That Frank broke because he's a dickhead.
To tie it back into manga, though, you see kind of the same thing, where it's like people are critical of manga, and it's not always just like the author's fault. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just because the author's a dickhead and makes bad decisions. I know that it's like a lot of time when I would criticize Bleach, I'd just be like, he was a bad writer. And I still do believe that, but... There are more factors that go into it, you know. It's not just a matter of like, oh, you made a bad decision. It could be that they were influenced by reader response polls. It could be that they were influenced by their editor, pressure by their editor. Even the most high up of editors, most high up of manga creators can get pressured to make decisions a certain way, based on that kind of stuff. So, you know, you're never gonna know the story 100% unless they flat out tell you. Which is actually a lot of how you learn about behind-the-scenes stuff in wrestling. So, But to move on to more questions, we've got a few from The Great Rapsode. Dear Chris, goddammit, Chloe, stop getting yourself killed, Larios. And Nick, goddammit, Frosh, why couldn't Gray just kill you, Freeman? You're so cute. So before I start the questions, I wanted to say I've been a fan of yours for a while, and I love whenever you guys talk about Fairy Tale because I genuinely like the series. Love how your guys' critiques of it due to the fact that you seem to judge it more as moderate readers than as fans, which is why I see more people on YouTube tackle it as. You guys are always funny, and I wanted to let you know that you make me smile. That's really nice, and B, I think that is actually one of the highest compliments that we've been given, is that we can be good reviewers without being biased about a certain series. So there you go. Mm. First question, wanted to know if you could take the mangaka of all the series you recap and assign them to a different series from the ones that you would recap, meaning they could start the series from scratch and have to do with the same world and cast of characters, but for example, you put Tabata on My Hero Academia and it becomes more standard Baoshun, or put Ashihara on Fairy Tail and becomes more story, diving into the politics and world, Horikoshi on One Piece becomes more deconstruction of pirates and government. Who would you assign and how would the story be affected? We have answered variations on this question before, but we've got a very different lineup than I think the last time that we answered it, so I think that could lead to some different ideas this time.
This is a tough one, actually. I think the easiest one, like, to make something that would be, like, a good transition would just be putting, like, Horikoshi on One Piece. I think just kind of, like, would fit pretty easily. Like, they have the same kind of mentality, I think. Between him and Oda, where I don't think there'd be a drastic, huge change. Like, he also is somebody who can recognize, like, the importance of side characters, giving them emphasis.
Right. I could definitely see Horikoshi being able to handle a core group as large as the Straw Hats, given the way that he uses the entire class of 1A, basically. Let's see. If we're going to do that one... excuse me. Shit. I actually think it'd be really interesting to, I need to actually look up the, series authors' names and stuff, hang on. If you did My Hero Academia with, what are their names?
Oh, from the Promised Neverland?
Yes.
Shirai
and Demizu. Because, you know, they've managed to take an idea of, like, oh, you know, the world is occupied by demons and stuff, and done something very different with it. I think that it would be interesting to see, like, you know, a world of superheroes done by them.
Yeah, I can absolutely see it. You know, I have a lot of trouble thinking of, like, answers here that don't, like, just make me sad, because I'm just like... Well, what happened if you made Tabata the lead of, like, the Promised Neverland? It's like, well, they'd get out of the fucking school in, like, a week. Because it's too sad otherwise. Like, it's too pure. There's not complexity there, which isn't, like, the style he goes for. So I think maybe Tabata on Fairy Tail actually might be a pretty big improvement. Because you probably get at least a little less, like, blatant fan service put in, but still the same end result of, like, the heroes win. Because that's generally how Fairy Tail goes, without the annoying points of, hey, guys, look how tragic this scene is, because this one character is dead now. Oh, wait, they make him back on their back.
Yeah, in the next chapter, yay!
Yeah. Tabata hasn't done that shit in a while, but...
I think that it would be interesting to have Inagaki and Boichi in charge of We Never Learn. It probably wouldn't be especially different, but, Inagaki's got experience with writing for, you know, high school settings and stuff, and it would be interesting to have the kind of over-the-top nature of his writing and Boichi's art style as well, present in that.
Yeah, I can see it.
Okay. All right. So, moving on from that, we've got another one. As Chris has said before, Rave Master had much better villains than Fairy Tail. I wanted to know, Chris, using what memory you have of Rave Master, to tell us who your favorite villain was. Or I guess you can also save this for the Rave Master discussion.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about Rave Master probably like a week or so. So we'll be talking about it a little bit on there. But there are still a lot of good villains in Rave Master. It does still have some of the issue that Fairy Tail does, where there are some that get introduced who you're like, I don't remember much about this dude. Feels like he didn't do a whole lot, like the ogre guy who shows up part of the way through. But I think one thing that's kind of notable was the Oration 6 in this series. Like, those actually felt like a distinct group of characters who were pretty terrifying all the way through. Like, they were all pretty significant members in and of their own right. So I really like this the Oration 6 in that. I think Reyna was the one with, like, the green hair, and that was Siegfried, basically. I'm forgetting the name of the dragon guy that was in that group, but he was really cool. Just a good group of characters. Shuya? Is that the name of that one, dude? Fuck. I'm blanking a lot of characters' names because I don't have my list of characters in front of me right here, but there's a lot of really cool characters in there, villains in that group.
All right, third question. Nick, you just have been made the new captain of the Black Bulls. How do you intend to make the Black Bulls have a better reputation to the Clover Kingdom? Well, as we've seen recently, it seems that their reputation is actually improving by leaps and bounds of late. So I'm not sure that I would actually do a good job at this, apparently. I think that my main concern would have to be just kind of like focusing on like individual personal improvement for the members. You know, obviously there's a lot of like weird hangups that some of them have, which cause them to one, act out, and two, not be as effective as they could be. So if, you know, you help them work through that stuff, they could probably do their jobs better without causing trouble by, you know, creeping people out by talking about their sister or hitting on women that when they should be doing their job or eating food when they should be doing their job or hiding in their room because they're shy, that kind of thing.
Well, then you wouldn't have, then you wouldn't have a wacky group, though.
I know.
All right. I just want to know. Yeah, okay. Fair
enough. My job is to make them have a better reputation to the Clover Kingdom, not necessarily to just run them.
That's true. That's true.
Fourth question. If you could have Murata take one real NFL match and draw it like an iShield 21 style match, which NFL match would it be?
I think the answer has to be, at least in my mind, Super Bowl 42, because that happened right during the time of iShield. And it was such a perfect kind
when they went to the World Cup, they showed like, oh yeah, the New York Giants won the Super Bowl.
It's like, and that's the perfect kind of game for that too, where it's like, hey, the underdog team managed to beat this unstoppable juggernaut in the crazy
place. In the most poetic style possible too.
And the insane,
last minute drive.
The insane amount of things that went into that final drive too, where like the almost interception that could have ended the game. The Tyree catch, the touchdown to Burris, which was basically done because it was like the single, they were like, we're just going to go with the easiest play. And the defender just didn't see it until he saw Burris was like shooting out. And he's like, God damn it. I'm never going to catch that guy. Like it's perfect. You can't really get like a more poetic, like I still look at 42 and I'm like, it feels like somebody wrote this. Like this feels so fake when you look at it in a way.
Speaking selfishly, Super Bowl 37, because that's the one the Bucks won. Just because, I know.
I was gonna say, it wasn't even competitive really, right? Like, they destroyed the Raiders.
No, they basically creamed the fuck out of them. I don't fucking care. Go Bucks. In terms of actually good games, I mean, first off, I think you kinda have to do, if not a Super Bowl, then just one of those, like, legendary games. Actually, to go back to another Buccaneers game, there's a one that they had with the Rams right around the time that I was first starting that was this ridiculously back-and-forth, high-scoring game that I think would work really well for it. I mean, let me see if I can find the score, because it was around 2001 or something like that. 11-26-2001. What was the fucking score? No, that wasn't it. Hang on. I'll find it eventually. If you're going to go for like Super Bowls, the Rams and Titans is a good one.
Yeah. 1 yard short.
1 yard short. Like that would be a freaking beautiful moment to capture with them stretching the ball out and falling just short. And it would be a different finish for an iShield 21 style one. Like,
Super Bowl 46 actually worked too. That was the other Giants Patriots one. And that one ends in like a really, cause it's another one where the Giants kind of got ahead. You could use that big moment when they let the Giants score so that they could march down the field again.
Yeah.
And you could get that crazy moment. Cause it did come down to the last seconds where they threw it up in the air and there was a very good chance that Gronk was actually going to get that. You know, basically it's knocked out of his hands, but that came up to a Hail Mary in the end zone that they almost got. So that'd be another really good one to cover.
In terms of like, you know, Super Bowls though, I think you really do have to just go for Super Bowl 42 because it's so well divided into like sections.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, there's the start where the Giants just, there's like two drives in the entire qual for as long as they possibly can to keep the Randy Moss and Brady off the field. And then by the end of it, it turns into a much more offensive game. The long drives by both teams to finally win it.
And so many stories in it too, where it's like Strahan, who never got a ring to that point. This was Eli basically trying to prove himself. Tom Coughlin on the hot seat.
The undefeated New England Patriots to that point and lost the game.
Yeah. I mean, and Eli as the younger brother of the other big quarterback in the league. Yeah.
It's kind of just too perfect, honestly. It's the most perfect game, I think, in NFL history, or at least modern NFL history, to be converted into a movie or a story of some kind. Yeah.
The fact that, like, by the way, the dude who makes that catch is, like, a relative nobody on the team, too. Yeah.
By the way, to let you know what Bucks-Rams game I was talking about, it's the December 2000 game that they had where the final score was 38-35.
Ah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, high-scoring
game. And it was...
That would be a good one.
Okay. Good question. If you want us to be happy, then ask us a football question. Final question, going back to Ravemaster, one of my favorite fights is Haru versus Dalton, where Haru faces the member of Deep Snow's group, who's basically a metallic insect, and uses webbing to cocoon. Haru's friend Soren Rave stones up with, looking bad for Haru, he actually uses the super strong webbing against Dalton and makes a makeshift mace slash flail tool. It forces Dalton to the ground, and then Haru manages to dent Dalton's armor with his fist, even fitting in a nice reference of how his opponent was the guy who would turn his skin to metal. Point of why I bring this up is I found this a pretty clever and innovative way to beat a villain with all the handicaps given. So the question is, what are some of your guys' favorite fights where the fighter has to get innovative to beat the villain? Innovation being a focus of the hero overcoming the villain. Using water, his own sweat, and blood, is a pretty good example for when he fights Crocodile.
His own blood is a great answer, actually. That was really, that was a moment, too, that I used to reference when people would say One Piece is too kiddish, like too childish. I'd be like, dude, when Luffy beats one of his villains by bleeding so much that he can counter the dude's ability, like, that's a crazy scene. You know, I'm gonna be boring and say it. There's the JoJo fights that are like that. The one that I always will go to, though, is, in part 6, there's a villain who creates the ability to basically bring moments back to life and things like that. So he basically traps the heroes in this plane crash where only 2 people survived. Then before he's done, he just throws a bunch of orphans into it too. So they're like,
oh, wow.
Shit, we have to save everyone. This plane's going to crash. How do we get it so we survive and these kids survive? And they have to use their power. So they basically, they take the 2 people who survived in the plane, kick them out of their seats to put the kids in it. Then they have to use their powers to basically trap themselves between those 2 people who survive because they also know they survive. So it's like, all right, well, I'll squish myself between them. And then you use your stand to unravel yourself down to the string and shove yourself down my throat so that way you're trapped inside of me. And that way we'll survive. It's like, there's so much I had to go into that to survive just a plane crash. It's fucking absurd.
Good stuff.
Yes. All right. Thank you for the questions. We'll go to some questions here from Michael Hurt, who says, hey, Chris Rolotin. There's a whole thing here. Along the ground as a bag of chips get heavy as my weight rolls away. Right. Just like Sarada having... Hold on. Where does this go? Really hope this lumpy space princess voice is still funny 3-something months from now when this email is sent Freeman.
Hey, what are you talking about?
Oh, yeah, there's Ray in there, actually. Okay, I get where this is going. I'm just trying to remember who Choo-Choo is. Is it the dog from One Piece? Cho-Cho?
I think, Cho-Cho is the character from Boruto, the Choji and Karui's daughter.
Oh, is it? I'm thinking there's a Cho-Cho from One Piece, which was the dog from the Orange Island arc way back in the day.
So the joke is Rolotiing, and then she interrupts along the ground to get a bag of chips as heavy as my weight. Woo!
Oh, like a Zoidberg? Like, woo, 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 woo. Okay.
And Nick, why am I the ruler of time? And then Ray interrupts. Actually, like, I was the original ruler of time because, like, when you are so awesome, you get to keep your baby memories as, like, a baby. You also can, like, see and deconstruct time better than anyone else can ever. But I'm, like, too cool for the title. So I gave it to Nick so he could be, like, 0.5% as cool as me.
All right. That's very fitting, then. First question from Michael. He says, one thing I've noticed since the One Piece time skip is, though, honestly, the story has been much better constructed and interconnected. And thought a lot of the fights seem to have been short-lined, either being a lot shorter or a lot more of it is shown off-screen. Do you think Oda no longer cares about the action of One Piece as much anymore, or he's saving the action for specific arcs, or he can't dedicate the space he used to for fights years back? This is a very interesting question, actually, because it is something that's noticed, and it is a lot harder to enjoy some of the fights in One Piece as much as I'd say probably the last time they were really great was during the Enies Lobby arc. Now, there have been some great fights since then. Like, I love Usopp versus Perona from the Bark. But fights, in general, have been a lot more abridged. I think part of it might be because Oda is trying to save some things for later on. this is a series that continues to just keep going, and in every new arc, they kind of are introducing some villain group the heroes need to fight. And I think we're seeing the Straw Hats evolve into stronger and stronger forms, but I think there's eventually going to come a limit where it's just like, all right, I can't keep like putting this stuff out there, or there's no way for me to top it when I get to the end of the series and they're fighting like the Blackbeard pirates, or, you know, when they're fighting against Kaido and his crew or things like that. Like, I feel like, eventually we just kind of need to like be like, all right, we'll do a lot of this off screen or something like that. It also helps that he's switching around to other characters now, like with all the, side characters that joined the Straw Hats as like friends basically in the last arc in Dressrosa.
Mm-hmm. I'm willing to guess that, the action part of it is not as much of his focus at this point, whether it's due to a lack of interest in it or whether it's because he's not coming up with as many ideas for how to do a complicated fight anymore. It does seem to be clear that his energy is more going towards like the wider picture of things. And I think that he is probably saving his effort for the parts that really, really matter. I mean, I would say that the fight with Doflamingo was at least serviceable for what it was trying to accomplish at that point. It might not have been like, oh, this is one of the best fights in One Piece ever or anything like that, but it was definitely good enough for what it had to be.
Yeah.
So I do think that it is probably a combination of different factors that are essentially taking his attention away from doing big fight scenes in order to do other stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. By the way, just because it got brought up, Usopp versus Perona is another fight where it's like an ingenious innovation way that defeats the villain. Usopp fights a lot like that.
What a freaking weird way he ended up defeating her too.
Yeah, it was great. That's one, maybe the most underrated fight in One Piece in my mind, because that is a brilliant battle.
You cannot make Usopp feel depressed.
I'm already negative. All right, question two here. This doesn't really relate to manga, but rewatching part of the old Last Airbender crossover you guys did, there was a joke for a while. Chris has apparently only ever seen 4 movies in the course of his lifetime. When did that change? And of all the movies you've seen recently, what's been your favorite/least favorite? So this is a joke that's existed basically for a long time and still does really exist. I didn't see a lot of movies growing up. There's a huge spectrum of movies I just haven't seen. Like, I haven't seen any of the RoboCop movies except for the newest one, the reboot. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen any of the Indiana Jones movies. I haven't seen any of the Terminator movies except for,
there are jokes that had to do with the Book of Eli or something like that.
Yeah, I've seen the Book of Eli, and it was awful. It's the stupidest twist that this fucking super awesome badass is also horrible. Blind. He's blind. And it's like, oh, but he's been doing all these things blind. Yeah, it's like, this is fucking dumb. Anyway, I didn't see a lot of movies growing up that were like cult classics or just like the essential movies for what you think. Like, I haven't seen E.T. or The Goonies. Things that like people are just like, you haven't seen that for my age range. But I had seen a lot of bad movies. Like, I had seen White Chicks. And movies that just showed up when I had friends or family over and they wanted to watch it on television. Like, it's not like I went out to be like, I wonder if White Chicks is amazing. But that was basically it. I have seen a lot more movies since, and a big part of that was because I think it was 2014 through 2015, I was doing a podcast with Randy, Exposition Up, where we saw at least a new movie basically every week. I saw a huge selection of movies during that time. A lot of great ones from it. If you just talk through that, Rush is one of the favorite movies I saw from that. It's a movie about F1 racing with Chris Hemsworth and Daniel Brühl, and it's outstanding. It like captures everything that makes sports competitive and compelling for me. That's a really great one.
I ended up appearing on that so we could talk about Edge of Tomorrow, the All You Need Is Kill movie. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was pretty hard on, despite the fact that I really liked it.
And from that, I've definitely seen a good collection of awful movies. I, Frankenstein is one of the worst, but I love it because of how bad it is. The fact that it ends on that stupid forced, like, quote, title drop is fantastic. If you're just, like, an awful movie all the way through, it was probably The Legend of Hercules, the one with, Taylor Kish, I think it was. Whatever the kid from Twilight was. He was the lead in that one. It was the one that wasn't with The Rock, and it was awful. It's so boring. I fell asleep in the movie theater watching it. And it was in the same weekend I think I saw, it may have been the same weekend I saw Her, which is another amazing movie in my mind, and, Lone Survivor. I think it was the same week essentially as that. So I saw two amazing movies and then just one piece of garbage, basically. But, fun. Yeah, those are some great ones in there. Yeah. Question three, if there was a popularity poll for weekly manga recap, what would the top 10 look like? And note, WMR eligible characters include the hosts, any guests, and title card, visual artists, fan created characters, and of course, items like Chris's honey mustard and Nick's Pop-Tarts.
I'm not sure who the most popular of our created characters is, honestly.
I would say the one that would probably be the first would be the only one that I know right now that has a Twitter account, which is our version of Ray. Which is what, @OneTrueRay, I think is the Twitter handle, so.
Yeah, OneTrueRay, yeah.
That would probably be the most popular one on there, but
Right now, I would guess it would be Ray. Although I'm not sure if people are ever gonna sour on him, or if we'll eventually just get sick of doing that, or what. I think it would have to be one of the ones that we've done very consistently. For example, Unohana, I'm sure, would probably be up there because we did Dead and Never Coming Back for her so very much. Let's see here. What was the one you mentioned?
Yuabok.
Definitely up there.
Yeah. Probably. I don't know. Again, this is like that thing that kind of comes into it where it's like it's really tough for me to gauge our own, like, jokes and creations and things like that. It's just sort of a weird thing. So I don't know. That's something I think almost the audience would need to be pulled on.
Yes, great. Yes.
But thank you for the question, Michael. Those are some good ones in there.
All right. So we've got more questions from Andre Golden next. Dear Buffy the Vampire Slayer, I'm not sure how that's related to my name at all.
I think it's just because...
because you're charmed tea.
Well, they're two supernatural, like... female-driven 90s quasi-action series, and I think I'm charmed T in your Buffy the Vampire Slayer solely because of Why Ruler of Time sort of thing. I don't know.
Yes. I love listening to your lovely voices, so I wonder if you could swap voices with anyone in the world, who would it be? And yes, they will gain your voice.
Ooh. I guess if I could take probably Hank Azaria or Dan Castellaneta, like take someone from The Simpsons who's like got like a famous repertoire of like 7 different voices or something like that. I mean, I guess I'd fuck up The Simpsons at that point because it's like, I don't know, my new voice can only do like 4 impressions and they're all awful or something like that. But like, fuck, if you gave me the choice, yeah, I'd do that. Heartbeat.
Yeah, I think, I guess if you give the option of being able to trade voices, then yeah, I'm going to end up doing it with someone who I can do a bunch of voices with. Like, if you're going to go for The Simpsons, then someone like, you know, Hank Azaria, who does a bunch of different ones, I would go with.
Yeah. Good question, though.
Also, there's a note here. I love Nick's reaction when he looked up The Loud House and Nikki, Ricky, Dickie, and Dawn. I know that was in the September Q&A, but that always makes me laugh. I literally do not remember what that was. That was nearly a year ago.
All right. So, we got a question here from Knopfor. It says, Dear Nick, there's a fine line between not listening and not caring. I like to think I walk that line every day of my life. And Chris, you will fear my laser face. Oh, wait, hold on. Is there more? No, okay. Okay. I thought the rest of that line was actually an entire, like, finishing part of my quote. This is Knopfor, despite starting off my email by reminding Chris that his life is hollow and less meaningful because he hasn't watched all of Red vs. Blue. I'm actually more mad at Nick. Ooh. The reason I'm so angry about this is that, like you, Nick, I've read Kenichi, and I think my thoughts on it are similar to yours. It's pretty good unique at first, though a little insulting how its main character refuses to hit a girl, even if she's literally trying to tear his balls off, but gets bogged down by too many pointless characters of fan service that gets in the way of almost every fight. And you may notice these problems are almost exactly the same ones as Fairy Tail. And here's this question. Given the manga series after Kenichi, which was a giant pair of bare breasts on its first page and an ass on every volume cover, do you think Hero will end up the same way?
He might, but there have been people who have been telling us that Hero is kind of sick of doing Fairy Tail and sick of his magazine. So I don't know. I guess that if he does stick with it, you're probably going to see fan service in the same way. Because of, we've just recapped there with the magazine just kind of tends to have a reputation with very fan servicey series or series that become more fan servicey over time. So if he ends up sticking with Weekly Shonen Sunday or something like that?
Yeah, something like that. Whatever. Shonen Sunday.
Then
probably going to end up being the same way.
It could end up going either way, but I'd like to think he'd still be possibly drawing something, at least with an adventure tree. I don't know how extreme his fan service will get. I really don't know if that was something he really, like, the editors and kind of, like, brought in, like, hey, Bill, you know, more. And he was like, whatever, I like it too. If he'll just keep doing that or if he'll tone it back. Because, I mean, rereading Ravemaster, I'm like, yeah, there's still a lot of fan service in this, but not nearly to the same extent. So, who knows?
Hmm.
Next question. Do you think Hero's next work will end up having all the same problems he developed with Fairy Tail, or do you think he'll be able to rise above them and make something great again, like with Wave Master?
That is something that only time can tell.
I honestly couldn't tell you there. I'd like to hope that he could, at least in the sense of creating something more along the lines of what Wave Master did narratively and everything else, but who knows? I mean, that was probably, what, 15 years ago almost at this point? I mean, like, it's been a while. Like, Fairy Tail hasn't been running that crazy long, but it's been running a decent amount of time, and there was a period of, like, time between Ravemaster ending and Fairy Tail beginning that he was doing, like, side series and things like that, so who knows? He also experienced a lot more success with Fairy Tail than he did with Ravemaster, so
true. Something I got to say. I do think that Hero is capable of doing much better than what he has been. But whether or not he lives up to that, only time will tell.
And he finishes this off with kind of a question to us, actually. He says, another reason I believe a lot of editorial content is going on with Fairy Tail is because of what happened with Nejima. How much do you two know with what went down with that manga?
Not a whole lot. It's got the reputation that it was pitched by Arakawa as basically just being a new Love Hina, and then it turned into something completely different because he kind of just snuck it in. And then transform the series gradually from what the initial premise was. But I don't know about the editorial, fiddling that went on beyond that.
Yeah.
All right. Next from Jack Lebrano. Dear Nick Threeman and Chris Larry Zero, not trying to be mean, I legitimately couldn't find any numbers that would fit well within your name. Oh no, Chris, you're the number 5 Pink Ranger now.
No, I got demoted.
Recently, or by the time this gets to you, 8 to 9 months ago.
Hey, we're a little bit faster than that.
Finally caught up with all of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, and as I'm waiting for how JoJo will defeat the limbless homeless man who's able to turn people into tracking rage zombies, okay. I must ask, of all the parts of JoJo you two have covered thus far, which is the best and most hilariously random moment to bring up out of context? Well, the strength is a pretty good example. These guys land on an aircraft carrier. The girl who's traveling with them decides to take a shower, and then she gets nearly molested by the thing that is controlling the aircraft carrier, which is an orangutan.
Yes.
That's pretty good. Did you see the other orangutan coming out of the wall while the girl showers? That's a great out of context moment.
Yeah. Murderous orangutan pervert who controls the ship that they're on. It's pretty strong. One I always like to go to is the end of part 2, where it's like, Joseph flies a plane into a god to knock him into a volcano while he's being eaten alive by piranhas. That's a great, like, just like quick series of words. Just like, what? What is it you're reading? What's happening? And also, part 7 is a horse race across America while finding the parts of Jesus Christ. I mean, yeah. I explained it earlier, but that is a great just sentence to say and to know that is a very accurate description of it. Also, yes, heroic Nazi cyborg that later becomes the character design for Guile was a good one as well that Jack brings in there. All right. This question, these are from Kenny Varnth. It says, dear Nick Swartzen, ruler of Pretend Time, Freeman, and At Midnight with Chris Larius. I don't know which one of us got out the better on that. I like Nick Swartzen. Mm-hmm. But At Midnight, I mean, arguing Chris Hardwick has succeeded more than Nick Swartzen, I think, is a pretty easy claim to make. I don't know. That'll be up, I guess, for time to tell overall.
Yes.
Questions here. One, for Chris, what was it like getting to be part of the mob that beats the shit out of Dr. Insano for raping Santa in the Ultimate Warrior comic review? Well, I'll tell you, I have such vivid memories of this that until you brought it up, I had forgotten I was a part of it. There's a lot. There's a lot. And that's not to be insulting. I forget a lot of the things I'm in. Like, there's a question we just got recently. We won't get to it for a couple months, but someone mentioned, like, how they were watching old Until We Went episodes, and they were like, did you lose weight because you wanted to stop being the fat guy in those videos? Like, I forgot I cameoed in a few of those. Someone who was, you know, hideously overweight. I forgot I was in a lot of these things. A lot of the Channel Awesome productions, just because there were so many of them, especially when we were, like, you know, doing one of our get-togethers, you often would just be like, hey, come film this thing with me, be in it. And then once you were done, one of the other people involved would be like, I got my thing I want to do. Come on, you guys can all be a part of that too. So, you know, I was in stuff I forget. I think I'm in something that Phaelus and Cinema Snob did, where they were going around the hotel, and I just said something like, you guys sucked on Transmission Awesome or something like that. I think I'm a part of something they did too that I couldn't remember completely what it is or where it is. So I will say that it's a moment I'll never forget.
Okay.
Question two, for Nick. You said that Ruby is overrated because it's basically an amateur webtoon that blew up tremendously in popularity, sort of like what happened to Sharknado, even though it's a sci-fi original movie. Would you have the huevos to say the same thing if you end up reviewing the official Toho Project Doujins on WMR, a product of a multi-million yen franchise that was created by only one man that's been around for 2 decades, has over 20 games, including 2 fighters, is some of the hardest bullet hells nigh video games ever made, has dozens of waifus, etc., 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 and apparently a very large fan base. Nick, would you be willing to review Taho Project Doujins, I guess?
They're doujinshi, so no.
Ooh.
It says official Toho Project Doujins, but if it's doujinshi, that means it's unofficial, doesn't it?
I guess you could say, like, they gave the permission to do it, like, they endorsed it, or gave their blessing.
Doujinshi is the Japanese term for self-published works, usually magazines, mangas, or novels. Hang on a second. Toho Project Official Doujinshi. Yeah. God, I don't even know. I guess in terms of, like, their spin-off manga of a video game, I guess, and if they're bad, I'll say they're bad. In terms of, like, if the franchise is overrated or not, bullet hells are just not my type of game at all. I know that Toho Project has a very, very large fan base. I mean, like, you'll see discussions of that stuff just kind of pop up every now and again. And yes, I have heard that there are billions of waifus. I was in a group about 6 or 7 years ago, and there were, I would see, you know, people discuss that, and I'd be like, what the fuck are you talking about? I don't understand who the fuck this is. I had no idea how the hell you could possibly get into it when there was just representation of a bullet hell boss or whatever, or what the fuck ever. It's just not my type of game, so I'm never going to actually be able to tell you if it's overrated or not. Whereas I can watch a show that has, you know, a basic storytelling narrative, and then tell you, this isn't good. I don't know why there are people who are into this. So, sorry, that's a little bit of a cop-out there.
Yeah. All right, question three here. Have you ever read the Time Cube Theory? I don't think I've ever read it, but I'm aware of the Time Cube. I remember going to the website a couple times after hearing people talk about it and how it was just, like, inane gibberish. Like, kind of, like, you kept hearing these insane, like, things that were, like, written across it and things like that. It was all, like, constantly done in various different, like, colors and, like, fonts and things like. Like, it was so weirdly formatted. But I don't know if I ever actually read the Time Cube Theory. I only ever went to the site when I was here, like, listening to a podcast and other people were talking about it. And I was like, what is this? Oh, okay. This shit's weird.
I haven't heard it in detail or what it's supposed to mean or anything like that. I know that it's basically nonsense, and I've heard the phrase used before. Most recently, on a song from the newest Alestorm album, which I fucking love, where basically the song is about how the world is actually flat, but they mention wielding the time cube and how apparently the fact that the world is flat allows them to travel through time. It's very nonsensical fun, and I treat it as such. So if it's based on an actual theory, that's kind of hilarious.
Yeah. All right. Question four here. Are you guys happy, jealous, / horrified that Benzai has become one of the biggest French-speaking YouTubers on the internet? And if so, what do you think of his hit show Hard Corner? And he gives links to some of his things. I'm extremely happy for Ben. I think it's amazing that he's gone that way. There's actually... There's something a bit interesting in this, in that there's actually an episode of Transmission Awesome when we were reviving the show that we recorded with Ben, and he talks about all this stuff. One of those days, I really need to just put it together, even though there's some issues with it that I can't quite repair. But he talks about how he's become one of the biggest ones there. He talks about his movie. We watched it in preparation for it. I'm insanely happy for Ben Zah. He's genuinely a very creative, a very fun, very cool person. And I'm very happy to see that he's taken off. And also that, there's these cultures in languages, you know, not American, things like that, that are able to build themselves in these ways. Like, I was able to recognize now that there's like a huge French market just for like the kind of stuff we do, but for French speaking, you know, audiences in general. I think Sad Panda is also a part of them, where he kind of found like a lot of success, you know, going with just a French speaking sort of, way of approaching content. I think it's great.
Ben's a cool guy. We make fun of him every now and then for various things that have happened now kind of a long time ago. Mm-hmm. You know, the stuff where, like, you know, he tripped because while calling Chris fat, or the fact that, you know, he's got terrible taste in movies.
Or yelled at me on Twitter for spoiling Game of Thrones. So literally the last interaction I've had with Ben's, I was him yelling at me for spoiling a Game of Thrones episode.
But, you know, I mean, like, he's very creative. He's got a great work ethic. And the few times that I've gotten to interact with him, he's been just been really cool. Been really open and nice and funny. And in terms of, like, the way that he shares his opinions and stuff, you know, he genuinely believes the stuff that he says, and he'll argue with you about it. So I appreciate that about him. He seems very open and honest about it.
Yeah, I do not know how my, any kind of, you know, I don't know if you can call it a career or anything like that, but how my, time on the internet would be changed if it weren't for Ben Zah, because I was such a huge fan of his, and his ability to actually, like, reach out and interact with me at that time, was a big part of me kind of getting to know a lot of the people in, that got the glass at the time, move on from there, and he was a very good friend through all that. So I have nothing but respect for Ben, and I'm very happy to know that he's doing well.
But also a little horrified.
Yeah.
Just want to clarify.
Question 4.1 here. Would either of you care to butcher the catchphrase of said show on stream, which, from my look, says, "Oi, bonjour et bon way, dans le dot corner!"
I don't speak French. I speak Spanish, so I'll give this a try. It's like, "Oh, bonjour et bienvenue dans le dot corner," I guess.
Now, you gotta do it with more push. Oui, bonjour, et bienvenue dans le hot corner.
Dans.
Dans le hot corner.
You can let us know which of us did that better or worse, if you speak French. Thank you.
Yeah. 5. Would you rather get blown up by a rocket launcher from Minnie Mae Hopkins from Grunsmith Cats, or get a grenade shoved down your throat that came from the pubes of Sleepy John Estes from Mad Bull 34? I don't know either of these characters, so I'm gonna say I'll take the explosive booger from Mr. Five from One Piece. And question 6 here, rate these characters from least to most American: Bean Bandit, Bandit Keith, and Chippity Crockett.
Okay, Bean Bandit is a character from Gunsmith Cats. Can't tell you anything else. Chippity Crockett is the guy from G Gundam that pilots the boxing Gundam that represents America.
Oh, that's pretty. That sounds pretty dope.
Yeah. In terms of most at least American, well, the fact that Chippity is not number one in the team in the, you know, G Gundam group because it goes to Japan, so that's very un-American.
See, bad example. I would actually argue differently. I would say Chippity is the most American because, well, I don't know anything about the first dude period, but Bandit Keith just wears an American bandana, and he still came in second place to fucking Pegasus in that tournament. So
that's true. A little girl.
Yeah.
That he told how to win, but you know,
little boy Mick. Let's, you know, come on. Men need to be acknowledged, Nick. It's troubling times for us. We need every chance we can get.
This is WMRA.
Yeah, this is / Red Pill recap. I think this guy.
Red Pill.
if Bandit Keith played an American themed deck, like it had a bunch of like fucking Yankee Doodle Dandies and like giant eagles that attack people, then he'd easily win. But if this dude's fucking robot is like a fucking Apollo Creed, like it has like Star Spangled Swords and shit, then he can't beat that.
Right, like the shoulder pads come off and become the boxing gloves. That's very American.
Oh, that's fuck yes. Come on. Yeah, it's gotta be him.
So yeah. Because I don't know anything about Gunsmith Cat's Guy, then yeah, I'm gonna agree with you. I just do think that it is worth at least discussing that there are limitations to the Americanness of all.
Yeah. They're just like, wait a minute, you don't remember Bean Bandit, aka the name of Warden Harding, one of your presidents? I'm like, no, nope, doesn't sound real.
Nope, no. Okay, next from Andre Golden. Dear Why the Ruler of Best Friends Whenever and Girl Meets World T, people have been talking about how awesome the new Pokemon of Sun and Moon is, so I wonder what you consider the worst Pokemon was in design, or personal hatred, or flat-out lame.
The first,
I guess you're talking about Pokemon games, I think.
I would assume he means individual Pokemon.
Because
there's a lot more like variety in that. And I could say the first one I ever remember seeing and being like, this is an awful design, was Spoink, which was half pig, half spring. And I just remember like, this is the fucking, you're running out of ideas. But I still like that gen for the most part. Stunfisk is one of the Pokemon that I've seen recently. I'm like, this is just fucking stupid. Like, this is so goddamn ugly. Just this lame ass tiny, like, fuck it. I know it's based on a real creature, but it just looked so dorky. Like, no, I felt like no one would want to use it. It's probably fucking Uber tier for all I know. I don't know, but it just looked so awful when I saw it originally. And I remember Seafarer, who's a huge Pokemon fan. I remember him messaging me after I made that point somewhere before. He's like, I actually got a shiny Stunfisk, not by trying to. It's the only fucking shiny I'd gotten to this point. I was like, I would burn my game. I would break it if like I got my first shiny. It's like, you got a shiny Stunfisk. Like, fuck this.
Trubbish is pretty goddamn awful. The trash Pokemon from Black and White.
I would agree with you, but I like it because it's supposed to be a gen based on America, and I love that they put that fucking shade in there of a trash-based Pokemon.
There's so much littering.
Yeah, like, it's legitimately like a real criticism of America that just went under-noticed.
Woobat is pretty awful.
Woobat's not great.
The weird flying heart nose thing.
I have a
strong attachment to Trubbish as my answer, though, because of the one episode of Best Wishes, the Black and White Pokemon anime series that focused on it, where everyone involved in it was just a big piece of shit, basically.
I'm trying to remember. Like,
there were these kids who had befriended a Trubbish, and their teacher wanted them to get rid of it, and it was for very legitimate reasons. And there was like some old wise mentor that the teacher had that basically, after everything was resolved, it turned out the Trubbish would stop smelling if everyone treated it nicely. And the fucking old woman knew this and didn't tell her, even though the problems that resulted from this caused like people to nearly get hurt from like their treehouse fork collapsing on them or some shit.
What?
So it was like, oh, you need to do this for yourself. It's like, bitch, kids were nearly hurt because of you.
Wednesday Dale Cheddar does bring up a good point that Spoink is brilliant because its Pokedex entry is, it stops jumping, it dies. Its heartbeat is literally connected to its spring bouncing.
Have you ever seen the webcomic where they make a joke about that, where like a girl is so enamored with it that she picks it up and immediately this Spoink is like,
you know what? Here's actually one I was looking through and I was reminded of one, and this is maybe a different one because this isn't like Spoink where you're like, what a stupid design. I hate Unpheasant. I hate Unpheasant. It is such a hideous design. I have never, I usually always use the bird Pokemon line from each gen, and I cannot stand Unpheasant. It looks so ugly in both versions that I just never bothered with it.
I do definitely remember being underwhelmed by the appearance of some of the birds. Was it? I think Tailwind and Swellow didn't really do it for me.
Tailwind and Swellow were basically also sort of weird.
Not the ugliest ever, but I didn't really like them.
Yeah, I could see it.
But then there's the Staraptor line, and that looks awesome.
Staraptor's great. Talonflame's pretty dope. I forget what the most recent one. Oh, it starts as a woodpecker and ends up as a toucan, which is kind of weird, but still pretty
That's
cool.
That's strange. Okay.
Yeah, whatever. Hawaii. Sure. Rainforest. All right.
Alola.
Yeah. Sun and Moon are great games. I'll give them that. All right. Yeah, sorry. So next question here, from no name on here. So, hey, happy Halloween, Nick and Chris. Ha. We're earlier than that slightly. Are there any famous events, pop culture, historical that have happened during your lifetimes that you would like to see adapted slash be part of a manga? Well, no, I don't need to because I already saw 9/11 in a manga thanks to Air Gear.
Thank you, Air Gear.
Yeah. Related, are there any people you'd read a biographical manga about?
I mean, we did enter a variation of this with the football question, I guess. That is a moment from history, you know?
There are a lot of biographies and things like that. There are a lot of just people with interesting lives that I would like to see, told in various ways. I don't know if manga would necessarily be the best one to be for a lot of them, but there are a lot of people who just have such interesting kind of lives that you read about that you're like, holy crap, I'd love to kind of see more about this. Especially when, you find out details about something. Like, when you find out about Kelsey Grammer and the just horrific life that guy has had, where you're just like, my God, this is, all I knew you were as the guy from Frasier, and then you find out, he's had to watch, two of his siblings die, and just the constant, strain that life had on it, it's insane. Look him up. The Von Erichs, I've always, I've joked about with my brother, it's shocking that hasn't been made into a movie at that point, because you're just like, what gypsy did your family piss off at some point in time? What genie did you make the wrong wish with that has cursed your family to just be this unfortunate?
Family, except for one person.
Yeah, five brothers, four of them died in a decade of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them were children at that time. It's insane. All right. Yeah, good question.
All right, this is coming from Drake Chandler. Hey, Nick, T-Ruler of Time, Freeman, and Chris, Rolo Wilarius. First question for you guys. I'm not going to bother guessing the goddamn date you're answering this, but it's currently March and you guys just announced your next review will be a Blue Exorcist. Man, it seems like forever ago, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Question's been on my mind for a while now, and now I must have it answered. You see, Blue Exorcist Season 2 is currently airing, but also other reviews you've done for mangas such as Snow White with Red Hair and Ajin, possibly more that aren't crossing my mind, all coincidentally have lined up with their anime adaptations airing at the same time. How much influence do you guys think anime adaptations have for your guys' list of recommendations? I know some of them have actually been deliberate. For example, Keijo was, one that I kind of picked out because it had made a splash on a lot of people's, attention. So I thought, oh, okay, this would be interesting for us to check out and do a manga review of, because it's on people's minds right now. And I think that it has the inverse effect on a lot of people. People are thinking about when they make the recommendations.
Yeah. That probably plays a larger part than we might realize. I'll tell you, I picked Snow White and the Red Hair, and I didn't pick it because I had heard it had an anime or anything like that. I was just like, oh, that seems interesting. We haven't done a shoujo in a while, like a romance series, so.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what it came down to. Alright, a good question there, Drake. I like that. There we go. This is another one from the Great Rapsode. This says, Dear Nick, just give Natsu a Red Eyes deck similar to Night Shroud because it's both fire-attributed monsters and dragons Freemen.
No, it's not. It's not fire-attributed. They're dark-attributed.
Oh.
They breathe fire, but they're not fire-attributed. Boom!
And Chris...
Don't step into my house!
This is my house! I'm coming for you! And Chris, yay, there are questions about Hearthstone. Shit, they're about fairy tale characters. I thought you guys should use some card game questions. Well, I do love those. First question. Chris, what Hearthstone deck would be most relevant for fairy tale characters? So basically, Natsu, Lucy, Grey, Urza, Elfman. Whoa, Jesus Christ! Nick,
too many in here, aren't there?
Feel free to jump on this question only with Yu-Gi-Oh characters. Alright, so there's some here that are very easy. Natsu would play a dragon deck. I don't actually know what Dragon Warrior was relevant for a period of time. Not for a very long time, but Dragon Warrior would certainly fit Natsu, so I'll go with that. Grey? Freeze Mage is a very popular one. It seems less, it's not as direct as I think he'd want, but it does fit him thematically, and I could see him playing that. Elfman, I guess, would just play whatever Astral Communion Druid, which is just the one that you play a card that discards your hand to give you full mana crystals, really early on, and then you just play really big shit after really big shit. It kind of fits him, I think. I don't know what Mira Jane or Lucy or Urza would really play. Now I have to kind of think of what their personality likes and find a way to variant that into, a Hearthstone strategy. Cause Hearthstone's a lot less about, monster gimmick things, per se. than it, like, what Yu-Gi-Oh! Is, where it's like, oh, well, you'd build a seven samurai deck or something like that. Like, there's not, like, a swordsman-style deck for Hearthstone, per se. So you can go through with a few, and let me see if I can think of any others.
Well, Lucy is difficult because there is a Western astrology set for Yu-Gi-Oh! You could give her some sort of, like, Constella, I think, kind of deck, but I think that probably a more appropriate one, because there's variation in her magic based on the constellations and stuff. You'd probably want to go for Zodiac to represent that. It's basically, you know, animals based on the Chinese Zodiac. Gray is easy. You go for Ice Barrier. Yeah, enough said. Urza is actually tough because there's too many goddamn sword and warrior sets in Yu-Gi-Oh! Like, way too many to goddamn choose from. Elfman, I think, would probably be Gladiator Beast or Gladial Beast, however you want to say it. You know, there's variation between them to represent his different transformations and stuff. Laxus, that's tough because a lot of the Thunder sets don't fit his style. Battery Man is, you know, like, too cartoonish. What are they freaking called? The name escapes me, but there's a lockdown Thunder set as well, and that doesn't really suit him. And there must be one that is appropriate and is just not coming to mind. And Juvia, there's a billion different water sets, so take your fucking pick.
Yeah. A couple other ones I thought. Gajio might be good with Pirate Warrior, because it is very aggressive into your face, but, there's somewhat of an intelligent mindset behind it. It's just very blunt and uses a lot of weapons. And Laxus, I'd say he'd use, like, mid-range Shaman circa the end of One Night in Karazhan, even Mean Streets of Gadgetzan, I think they were pretty huge, where they have a lot of thunder-based effects as Shamans, and then in general, they were just absurdly dominant. They were incredibly powerful. It was, I think the latter was made up primarily of Shamans during that time, which was pretty insane. So that'd be good. I can't think of anything that fits Lucy. There's no thematic constellation kind of things in the game, and I don't even know what class she really fits. Like, it's tough because they're all mages in fucking Fairy Tail, and that's like one class in Hearthstone, so, I don't really know where she'd be there. Maybe she'd be like a Discover Mage, because she likes exploring, but, Discover Mage is awful. It's not really a thing. You just put Discover cards in Mage. Building one off of that entirely seems like a bad idea.
Woo!
All right, second question here. Nick, in Red Right to Left, you said you need another anime to fill your card game niche, and then you cut to an image of the card fight Vanguard. What did you think of this series/game?
I was intending to watch it at the time that I made that video, and then I just never got around to it. But the point that I was trying to make, though, was that all of a sudden there was this thing that could fill that kind of need to watch something like it that Zexal might not be fulfilling. And Zexal is basically the series that kind of made me quit watching Yu-Gi-Oh! I did end up watching Arc 5 afterwards, but I was always behind on it, wasn't watching it as consistently as I had been when 5Ds was on. I know that there's the 6th series that has started very recently that I just haven't gotten around to checking out either. So Zexal kind of killed it for me, honestly, the fact that I just wasn't very interested in it. And now I don't watch anime consistently basically at all anymore, so...
All right. Third question here. Nick, what didn't you like about Crow from Yu-Gi-Oh! 5Ds?
It actually has to do with the John Cena thing that we talked about before. He was all of a sudden inserted into the story in order to promote a new line of monsters called Black Feathers, or Black Wings, if you're into the Nihon. He was originally just kind of going to be this, like, one-shot character, but then he just became a main character all of a sudden. First it was like he was part of this group that Jack and Yusei had run with, so he was suddenly a big, important character from the main character's past. He ended up being the only normal, quote-unquote, duelist to fight one of the Dark Signers and win. And then it turned out he became a Signer. Because, and then he was just the third most important character in the main cast, basically. He just completely shoved Aki and the twins out of that role. So there you go. And also in general, I just didn't like his personality. He was such a stereotypical. I read and wrote Yu-Gi-Oh! Fan fiction back in the day, and I knew a lot of characters that were like Crow. Just this shonen hero that was very unimaginative, was basically just the main character with some interesting elements stripped off and nothing to replace them with. And to have a character like that be given such a prominent role without ever really doing anything interesting, just fucking hated him.
All right.
So there you go.
I can dig that. The final question, Chris, which Straw Hat would you not want to play a Hearthstone Tavern Brawl against? So, for the context, Hearthstone regularly has these things once a week called Tavern Brawls, which are usually games where they put really stupid rules on top of it, like just for like fun one-off experiences. Like there's one where every time you play a monster, a spell of that same cost will randomly be played and it can attack any, like it could have all of its targets randomized. So you could play something that just completely destroys the, like, momentum of the game and swifts, like, changes the momentum around. They're very silly, but they're also kind of dumb at times because some of them aren't very well designed. I don't know if I think the only context for this would be, since most of it is just RNG, like how lucky you happen to be in the Hearthstone rules, this question mostly becomes which one would I not want to lose against the most, I guess, because they'd be annoying in that. And I don't know if there's a Straw Hat that would be like that. But if Spam Dam could be included, I feel like he would be a really annoying person to lose in a game to, because he would really know the other. He'd be laughing the whole time, and I'd just be there like, dude, like, it's fucking RNG, I couldn't help it. Like, you just happened to get better, like, effects than I did, and he's just like, ah, you suck, ah, I have a Mankind mask, ah, I'm like, fuck this guy. But thank you for the questions.
Yeah. Alright, we've got a few emails in a row here from Michael Hurt. Hey Chris, roloting an ooh song because Lil Yachty and Ariana Grande aren't as much my jam as obscure 1985 Pat Benatar jams.
I don't think Love is a Battlefield is an obscure Pat Benatar.
That is
hit.
Not.
That is
no.
Classic.
No, you want to do really obscure Pat Benatar, then you gotta go for stuff that doesn't even appear on our best of albums. Like yeah. The most obscure I could probably name is Outlaw Blues, and that's not especially absurd. Obscure, rather. And Nick, why am I the ruler of time? Insert the fifth explanation of where my screen name came from here, Freeman. I have some questions for you. Number one, considering the nature of this Q&A is answering questions, they're likely going to be pretty dated by the time you answer them. As I said, the sound of March and it will likely only be read by July 18th. Very close.
Yeah, not bad.
Do you think it's generally more annoying to read an especially dated question or more hilarious at how things have changed by the time you get to it? It's not annoying. We do take occasional enjoyment from it. I don't think that I've ever been like annoyed by like, oh, I can't believe you asked this question and didn't know that it would be months before I answered. So.
Yeah. I mean, part of the problem is we do get people who will ask a question and 3 months later we get to it. And in that 3 months we've answered it before. And maybe if we're like towards the end of the episode, we're tired or something like that, we might seem annoyed. But in general, the only thing I ever feel when somebody like posts like, hope you're not reading this by Christmas or whatever, and it's like New Year's or something like that. I usually just feel bad that it's taken this long for us to get to their question or something like that, but I'm never angry or something like that. They put the references in there. It's a funny way to call the fact that we've gotten really behind on questions because we get a lot of them, but
yeah,
I'd rather get more than not enough.
Number two, I noticed that some producers, when hitting certain goals on Patreon, are able to actually make their living off just making videos without having to work another job. How much per month do you think the two of you would have to make on Patreon in order to make that goal? That's something you have to ask. You don't want to answer if you don't want to. Just something I was curious about.
So there's a couple interesting things to this. So one thing to consider is that Nick and I share the Patreon. So it's
right.
You know, two essential, sort of salaries that would have to be in there in this notion. But I think the thing that's kind of, important to note out is that a lot of people, even people on Patreon, usually do not make their sole income through Patreon. For example, even just in this medium we're doing right here, there's a lot of people who can make their money in podcasts with still putting advertisements on it. There's some people out there who will stream content outside of it and get money through there. You could be like, teching where you create YouTube reviews and things like that. And that's where a lot of your income might come from. For us right now, we primarily just do the podcast and release content through there. So that's why the Patreon is kind of the biggest income we get through this, but there's other ways to make it, if you were asking, though, like, just what we need to do to make it so we wouldn't have to work a second job and could devote ourselves completely to the Weekly Manga Recap, It's a very hard number to even kind of put into say. Yeah. I would say right now we're not close to it. I don't think even if one of us took all the money from it, it would each month we'd be anywhere close to it. And I thought to say we want a shit ton more money or anything like that. That's not where I'm getting at all.
Yeah, give us your wallets, guys.
I'm like, come on, there's gotta be like, there's gotta be some wealthy motherfucker in this group who's willing to
put them in the cash slot that all of your computers have in order to transfer funds.
Give us all your bitcoins. Basically though, like if that's the goal, I mean, it's something that also you have to consider. If not, that's where we want to go. I don't know if me and Nick have ever had any kind of serious discussion on how legitimately we want to turn like online content creation like this into our long-term career options. But, you know, we've talked about other ideas and things like that we want to go to, and those could certainly be other avenues that could help us make some kind of return. So the options are out there, but, just for Patreon, it would be very difficult per month for us to get there. Even if we did reach that point, we'd probably have new aspirations for where we want to take the show or things like that. And it's just a very open-ended kind of attitude to get to.
Never say never, but it would definitely have to be significantly more than we're making from it right now. Like, at least probably about 5 times more. But, I mean, don't ask us to put a hard number on that, because, yeah.
And also, too, like, even if, like, say the number got to that point, I would start feeling like I'd want to devote myself to, like, putting out more for Weekly Manga Recap to reach that point. Because there's certainly no reason that I look at what we do with Weekly Manga Recap right now and I'm like, well, that's certainly worthy of a 6-figure salary or something like that. You know,
Right. I mean, that would definitely be something where if it got to that point, it would definitely feel like we would probably feel compelled to put more stuff out there.
Yeah.
And contribute more to and dedicate more time to it. Mm-hmm. Which I guess is what the original intent of the question is anyway. Number 3. All right. In the Yu Yu Hakusho Sensui art, one of the Sensui 7 was the child game master, the ability to bring video games to life, and in order for the group to get to Sensui, they had to beat his games and ultimately outsmart him. However, instead of Tsukihito Ananuma, I guess that's his name.
You got close.
What if the game master was Chris and he was able to bring Trollo T Trivia to life to try and block the heroes? Would the group have been able to perfectly defeat Chris at his most masochistic in the game, or would Kurama/Kaito/ the others there who aren't as smart been able to out troll the Trollo T Trivia master?
I don't know. That's a pretty tough order. As the master of all trivia, it's a tough task to get one over there. But the challenge would be who they're competing against, because that's the thing. Yeah, Trollo T Trivia it's not about me winning. It's about me using everything I've forged over my years of trivia. Essentially, I'm like trivia Batman. I had to spend out years in the trivia Himalayas, forging my body and my mind into the perfect trivia fighting machine. And now I'm out here.
I had to spend years out in the Himalayas. And by years, I mean hours. And by Himalayas, I mean on the Wikia that we're doing the trivia about.
Exactly. So, with that said, they would be posed up against somebody of equal caliber to their whatever knowledge of the topic they're doing. So, it comes to whether or not they can compete with them, I think. Nick, you know firsthand what it's like as a contestant, so...
Yeah. I mean, I think that they would probably go somewhere along the lines as it did in Yu Yu Hakusho, where the way that they defeated is by just making Chris feel very sad and realize that he's going to lose and die and then breaks his concentration.
Right? If you lost a fight in that thing, you just died?
Yeah.
I'm the host, though.
Basically, it went along the lines of if you die in the game, you die for real, and the kid did not understand that. He thought it was all actually a game, and Kurama basically realized what was actually at stake, and he lost concentration, and he died.
Huh.
Because Kurama's fucking hardcore like that.
I don't know. That'd be tough. Let's not dwell on that too much longer. I'm just gonna assume that I'd be okay, because I'm just the host. I'm just the proxy. Question again, Michael Hurt says, I forgot a question I wanted to ask you guys, so here it is real quick. I remember back in that there was a running joke in the late 2000s, early 2010s, where Chris had said that he hadn't really seen any movie. Oh, okay, never mind. This is something we answered earlier, and he just added
on to this one. Yeah, we just didn't say it. Okay. Another quick question from Michael Hurt.
Okay, sorry to keep posting these questions, but I've got another one I wanted to ask you guys, although this time more specifically to Nick, since he has admittedly recently, at the time of this email, said how much he loves Hawk and the Seven Deadly Sins and wondered if he loved Hawk as much as he hated Frosh from Fairy Tail. And also, if there was a spin-off of Hawk and another animal sidekick from manga solving mysteries in New York, who would you want to join Hawk in the weird proposed spin-off idea?
You would need to have an animal sidekick character that was logical and sensible.
Panther Lily?
Panther Lily, I think, would be a good fit. You know, a hard-boiled guy who, you know, bust heads to get the job done in order to bounce off of Hawk. Or even also Carla, I think, would be a good choice, too. Mm-hmm. Also from Fairy Tail. But you need to have a right balance in order for it to work. You can't just have all the wacky, goofy sidekick comic relief characters in order. It would dilute them, and, you know, it would just nothing would work. In terms of whether I love Hawk as much as I hate Frosh, hatred always trumps love when it comes to me. So there you go. all right. Next question is from, let's see here. Not four. Dear Nick, women are like Voltron. The more you can hook up, the better it gets. And Chris, I can bench a clean 200 no problem, do a couple hundred reps every day, 40 cock push-ups, no big deal. Are these things that we have said?
No, these are quotes from Red versus Blue.
Okay, got right. That's Church and Tucker down. I'm just going to keep throwing quotes to you until you give me a 12-page thesis on why seasons 11 to 13 Red versus Blue are so good they reunite your sex. All right. In an earlier email, discussed how the magazine that Fairy Tail runs in has a habit of making some of their series have required amount of fan service. Seven Deadly Sins also runs in that same magazine, and in your review of it, you said that a major hurdle in liking the series is Meliodas's perversion and how he constantly is groping Elizabeth. My question is, given how badly Fairy Tail fell in part of its excessive fan service, do you think the mangaka of Seven Deadly Sins put that really awkward pervert element at the front of the series as a precondition against more fan service being mandated on him? I think that's probably a little bit too specific of a thing. I would guess more that the reason why there's not more fan service than there already is because Seven Deadly Sins is super popular. I mean, it's incredibly, it sells really well. Like, you see it basically up there with main Jump titles, in the sales lists when it, for series. So I think that that's probably more to do with it. The mangaka also had success when he did Kongo Bansho, so maybe he had a little bit of sway on what he could do. And I think that probably he gets away with it because there's not so much fan service in Seven Deadly Sins, and yet it does so well. So he could probably point to that and be like, see, I don't need to have more perversion than I already do.
Yeah.
So. And that's it, I think. There's also a link to some AMVs, but that's it.
All right. There doesn't seem to be a name on this one. So, dear comrades, I'm trying to actually find where is the full question here. All right, so we'll just go through this. Nakarasawa was rightly praised for his ability to plan out his stories up to the end before he begins writing, especially in a medium such as manga that is published on a weekly basis and often vulnerable to editor interference, audience feedback, and author memory farts. And unlike that other authors, he almost never seems to forget or abandon a character or plot point that he clearly sets up in his work. Yet in 20th Century Boys, there's always been one thing that bothers me. In the first volume of the manga, Urasawa spends almost the entire duration setting up plot points and introducing us to Kenji's adolescent friends, almost all of which would play a major role sometime later in the story, even seemingly one-off characters like the twin bullies or the frog-faced kid. Yet in one page, Urasawa takes a significant pause to introduce us to a friend Kenji made when he was trying to become a fellow guitarist named Spider-san. Kenji mentions playing at Budokan, where Cheap Trick later made a famous concert destination, which apparently inspires Spider-san, who starts thinking and walks off his back to the viewer, while a small box states, 3 years later, Spider-san filled the Budokan. And as literally the last we hear of him, despite spending four pages setting him up and ending with a rather ambiguous closing line, and despite the fact that nearly every character that appears in the volume related to Kenji gets reintroduced to story later on, and even gets character arcs. Basically saying, what do you think happened? Do we think this was a rare lapse? That this is a plot element that was abandoned? What happened?
I think that the point was less to do with Spider-Son and more to just introduce that aspect of Kenji.
Yeah, I think actually this feels like something there that Urasawa could have brought up again later on, but it didn't need to. Like, I think that Spider-Son was a vehicle to kind of show Kenji's emerging interest in music and seeing somebody who could make a career out of it. Not just seeing oh, Cheap Trick made this stadium famous or whatever, and they were good. But by seeing somebody who we related to, somebody who he's like, I see this guy on the street, and he's a friend of mine, and seeing that he later on became a huge success, that was a very defining thing for Kenji to have. So he could have shown up later on, but I think it also would have been a little bit strange since Kenji, for a long part of that series, is, spoilers, supposedly dead. So where would he have shown up and been that relevant unless it was like a background character or some kind of thing? If he showed up at the very end, it might have just been like, I don't know, I think that was, it would be in a weird place then because Kenji kind of has had his development, so he needed to do other things. It's just my thought on that though. I see your point, is I want to stress, so I get that.
Yeah. Okay, so, I don't know, you want to do like one or two more maybe?
Yeah, that should be fun.
Dear, this is also from Now 4. Dear Y Ruler of Time Stand, the ocean breathes salty, and Rolo T Stand, face like thunder. This is Now 4, he who listens to alt-rock stations too much. Remember in my last email how I said I didn't have a good JoJo question? Well, I still don't. And instead have one that has probably been asked before, two that are completely unrelated. So Chris, can you give us a ranking of your favorite JoJo's from least to most favorite? I believe you have answered that question before. I think you actually answered it last time.
Yeah, so just like real quick, it's Josuke, Jolene, Joseph, Jotaro, probably like Johnny, Giorno, and then Jonathan. And I'm not putting Aiden there because I don't remember his name. I think he's actually supposed also just Josuke, but also I haven't finished that part, so I don't know him.
And Nick, you've only read three so far. Can you rank those? And with each new JoJo saga you read, update that ranking? Sure, I guess. It's Jonathan's at the bottom, and I'm not sure if I like. I honestly don't know if I like Joseph or Jotaro more at this point. Now for the unrelated. There are a wide variety of manga out there, from common shonen battle manga to shoujo, that are basically soap operas to some that are basically exploitation movies in manga form, which made me think, wow, this is like something I'd see in the Cinema Snob. And that's my question. What manga have you read that you would send to Brad Jones to review if he would be willing to? Interesting.
This is an interesting question. I admittedly don't have a very firm idea on like the exact criteria of what Cinema Snob reviews. Like, I know he reviews a lot of porn stuff.
Mostly does B-movies, exploitation films.
Pornos, I think, at certain points. I know someone mentioned he was doing King Dong at one point to me.
He's also been doing a lot of Pure Flix stuff.
Okay.
So
like, Akisora might fit into that wheelhouse, I guess.
Akisora would be perfect. Yeah, I was going to mention that one.
And maybe Crimson's? I don't know if, like, Crimson's is just so weird. It might be
I think that's weird enough that he would get something out of that, yeah. I think those are good, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, what's the one that we did? The Magical Girl Zombie one.
Oh, fuck. Majin, no. Magica.
Mahoshoujo. No.
Ah, fuck. Not Mahoshoujo of the End, right?
That was it, yes.
Oh, okay. Then, yeah, that one would have been in there. God, that was a weird one. that was a very strange one. Okay, yeah.
Also trails off into my next question. If you get your fellow Channel Awesome alumni to review some manga that kind of fit into the genres of movies that they normally review, what manga would you think that they would do? Well, I mean, I know that some of the alumni read manga anyway. Like, I mean, Linkara does. He's talked about how much he likes Steam Detectives. In order to fit into what kind of stuff that they normally review, though... God. Akisora would fit way too many of these really well. I know that... I'm sure that, like, for, like, Phaelus, we could... we would probably send him some of the bad horror manga that we've done, like, Ibitsu. I think would really work.
Ibitsu, definitely.
You know, terrible slasher film style one. Doubt, I think, would also work.
Get Linkara to read the Japanese Spider-Man.
Yeah. See how he reacts to that, man.
Yeah.
So there you go. This also leads me to a tangent, and there's a question at the end of this. This also leads me to a tangent. Hey, you do it all the time. Why shouldn't your fans? In a recent at present, a review of Gyo by Diamanda Hagen. She noted that the reason Junji Ito had so many weird twists in his manga, like the legs turning into machines, they're powered by bloated people farts, was because an associate of Junji said that his manga about an invasion of sticky fish on robot legs could not get any more ridiculous, which he took as a challenge. Does this surprise you at all, and does it improve your impression of the manga?
Yes,
not a really big surprise, and it kind of does improve my perception of it a little bit. Like, if he was just like, fuck it.
So we were aware there was some, idea of, self-awareness, because there's that iconic scene of the whale coming up and the legs just not being strong enough and it just getting crushed, and you're just like, why would you draw that if not to have some awareness of how stupid this premise was? But you do still have to note, even though he took that as a challenge and made it more ridiculous with fart power things and everything like that later on, he still came in with the initial idea of, these robot legs attach themselves to fish who then come up on land and smell really bad. Like, that was his horror concept for a manga, so it's still there. Right, there's still, a weirdness to it. But yeah, it's one of those so bad it's good kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
I lost my one on here. Okay, here we go. This is from Loon Ramayasha. Hey there, Nick.
All right, you're dead to me.
And Rolo to Nami.
Got the good one!
I did, although I like Nickelodeon. In the last email, I asked you guys questions related to Dragon Ball Super's Universe Survival Arc, which I regret because recently new details have revealed in the show as to what kind of tournament it is. It turns out in the Universe Survival Tournament is actually Battle Royale, where everyone is forced to fight all at once in a 45-minute time limit. No one is allowed to fly or kill. You are required to push your opponent out of the rings to defeat them, and the team with the most combatants left in the ring at the end of time limit is the winner. Also, 4 universes were exempt from entering, so there are only 8 universes competing. So under these conditions, and keeping in mind the importance of teamwork, if you were to pick characters from One Piece, Dragon Ball, Naruto, Bleach, JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, etc., against each other, which team do we think would come out in the end? This one Dragon actually, Ball. No, I think it would be JoJo. Cause there's a lot of characters in JoJo who were just, this comes down to whose team is more bullshit, and that's a battle between Dragon Ball, Bleach, and JoJo. And it's tough between which one between JoJo and Bleach is it for me. Cause while Dragon Ball has the characters who were just extremely powerful, they're all straightforward in that, whereas Bleach has characters who are I fucking will take any damage you give to me and get even stronger off of it, or whatever nonsense on that. So it just comes down to who wins the bullshit battle between the two of them.
Fair enough.
Question 2. Toonami recently celebrated 20th anniversary, so I want to know, what is your favorite Toonami experience or memory watching the block back in the day?
First of all, just in general, discovering new stuff through it. Outlaw Star was a big one for me. Getting to see new Dragon Ball stuff. That's how I ended up watching Gundam Wing and G Gundam and, Tenchi Muyo. Ronin Warriors 2 was on there. But, honestly, when I think of Toonami, the stuff that sticks out to me more is when they did their event specials, that focused on, Tom and the ship. The one where the weird, mass that starts growing and growing and taking over the ship, that was a really big event, and that's where Tom got his second design. That whole weird little short story was surprisingly good looking back.
Yeah, I can dig it. I watched a lot of Toonami, but I don't have, and I loved it, but I don't have, that kind of distinct memory from it. I guess it would just be the introduction to various series. I can remember having, arguments with my friend because I liked Rurouni Kenshin more and he liked Yu Yu Hakusho more, those sort of things. I always have a fondness for, the vignettes and everything, but I just don't, have that vivid memory of them the same way.
Mm-hmm.
3, what is your opinion of One Piece being taken off Toonami, presumably for good this time? Why do you think One Piece never caught on with U.S. television viewers, and do you think it could have been more successful on U.S. television if the 4 Kids dub never existed?
We can never know, Yeah. I do think that a lot of it had to do with the 4 Kids dub and with timing. There was a kind of window where Cartoon Network was really behind pushing anime series. And I think that if, for example, let's say that, you know, like the Funimation dub of One Piece came out when Toonami was really big on weekdays, I think that it would have probably caught on. But that's changing so many different things to do with it that, like, it's hard to measure what is actually responsible for not catching on as well.
There's also kind of something to bring up in all this is that the way we watch anime is very rapidly changing.
Because it is. Yeah.
You're looking at this thing of, like, it didn't succeed on Toonami, but it's just, you also have to think, like, a lot, like, My Hero Academia is hugely popular, and it doesn't air on Toonami. It airs, you pick it up on Funimation or on Crunchyroll or wherever you're gonna watch it there. Same with Dragon Ball Super. I don't think Dragon Ball Super, is, like, picked up by Cartoon Network or anything like that. You just catch that on Crunchyroll or whatever. So, like, maybe One Piece will never see a huge success there the same way, but I think that's kind of where that audience is trending to, and sort of the stuff that's going to be popular on Toonami or things like that is just stuff that has to achieve more to mainstream American stuff. Like, I don't, you know, Naruto didn't finish out its run in American television. Bleach didn't. So.
And, you know, Toonami's different now, because it's this, you know, late night block now, as opposed to it was an after school block back in the day. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, it's just sort of a different sort of culture, too, it's come about. Four. So Iron Fist was a real kind of mess and a real misfire for Marvel's Netflix series. What do you think was the show's biggest problem? How could it have done better? And how do you think the character of Iron Fist should be handled in Defenders movie 4? Do we have enough time to even get into this, Nick?
I mean, we could make an entire separate episode about this. mostly what it comes down to, though, is the fact that Danny sucks. He's just an awful character. He's not portrayed very effectively. It seemed like there are three different things that they were going for with him. There were times when they talked about how he was supposed to have all this great anger inside of him, which was very unconvincing when you consider what a weird shoeless hipster he was through the first few episodes. I'm not sure if he was supposed to be naive or wise or what. It just seemed like they didn't know what he was actually supposed to be like. And then when they introduced a love interest for him, the fact that she fell in love with him was completely unbelievable.
Yeah. I would say my biggest thing that Nick hadn't already mentioned is you made a martial arts series with really bad martial arts in it. So
yeah.
Go back and fix that up if you're trying to do him again. Like
make the drunken master fight be the baseline for all the other fights in that series, yeah. Basically.
It's a shame that the Netflix series most based around fighting probably had the worst fights in it and worst action. So,
get a lead actor who actually knows martial arts to begin with.
Or give him more time to at least learn it. Oh, God. He had like 3 weeks, I think, to like train before they started.
And, you know, you could say like, oh, that's a limitation of the budget or whatever. Like, then, you know, get someone who knows martial arts to begin with then.
Question five. No doubt you've seen the Power Rangers movie 9 now. We did not, so the rest of this question is irrelevant.
I saw the first one.
I saw both. You're talking about Turbo? Yes, I did see Turbo.
A Power Rangers movie.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really good when I saw it as a kid, and like, not so much now.
It was pretty exciting back then. You're like, hey, a kid could be a Power Ranger, then I can too. And then you grew up, and you're like, this kid sucks.
And we're like, fuck this kid, I want Rocky back.
Yeah. Six, it was recently announced that the Shonen Jump romance manga Strawberry 100% will gain a sequel manga. What romance manga, shonen, or otherwise would you like to see sequels to?
Nizukoi.
Yeah,
I'd like to see a sequel to
Nizukoi. You know, honestly, romance series are ones, I don't know if there's a lot of manga in general I usually like to see sequels to or anything like that, because they usually, you know, if the series isn't canceled, it usually wraps itself up nice enough. Like, if they added, like, made a sequel to Nisekoi, I'd be like, sure. But I certainly don't ask for one. Like, there's not, like, a whole lot of lingering questions around. I think romance series in general get less interesting when you stop. Maybe not less interesting, but they lose a certain dynamic to them when you take away the romantic angle of it and you just have to deal with the two characters surviving in a relationship, which is a perfectly, like, great thing to show and go through. But I think it'd be very different from watching, Raku and Chitage getting together to then watch them have to deal with, like, what it's like to live in an apartment together, or, you know, what it's going to be like when they have to start discussing values and what they're going to do financially in their future, things like that, you know.
In that same vein, though, Ouran Host Club, because that ended with the entire group just going together to school. So it's the exact same group. The only dynamic changing is the fact that Haruhi and what's-his-name are a couple now.
Takumi, I think? Takumi? Yeah. Also, it was in America, too. They were going to be in America then.
So, new setting with the base, the same core cast, and yeah.
If you gave me the choice, though, I'd have just preferred the Oran Host Club to have had a better ending.
Yeah.
And seven, do you think the next...
We don't actually have to grow up. Yay!
What are consequences? Do you think the Netflix Death Note movie will turn out well? And with Erased and Devilman recently announced to be getting Netflix series this year, what other anime and manga would you like to see a Netflix movie or television series treatment?
I do not know if the Netflix Death Note movie will be any good. I have almost deliberately avoided seeing anything associated with it because I want to kind of go in fresh when I eventually watch it. Mm-hmm. In terms of manga that I'd like to see get a Netflix movie or TV series treatment, I kind of wish that that was the route that All You Need Is Kill got. Maybe not Netflix specifically, but like a TV miniseries.
Yeah, I could definitely see that.
And I believe that we have talked in the past about, Monster.
Yeah, Monster would be
a real good fit for it.
You know, it's too early now, but, I mean, even if you change the way some of the story goes, The Promised Neverland would make a great kind of, like, you know, mini-series sort of series. Or I guess you can just keep doing it. The only issue is, how do you get kids that can act well enough to not grow up too fast, essentially?
They did it for Stranger Things, you know?
Yeah, and it worked for Lemony Snicket, although they're shooting two seasons back-to-back now just because they're trying to avoid that issue. So it could work. I think maybe if you just try it out to go with the idea of this going on for eight seasons with kids as the lead. But yeah, like you find good kid actor, you could do that. Yeah. All right.
Yeah, I'd agree that it would have to be like they'd have to wait until a certain amount of the story came up before doing it. So, okay. That is gonna do it, I think, for this time. So, thanks guys for sending in your questions. Of course, don't forget that you can, send in answers to the question we asked at the top of the show, rather. Make sure that you just caption or topic your email. With an answer for the July 2017 Q&A episode.
Yes.
And, so, we will be back with more, Weekly Manga Recap next week at our usual time.
Absolutely. So, reminder, guys, that's for your favorite themes in manga, or manga that handled some of your favorite themes or explored them. So, send that in with the answer, and that's it. Do we have anything wacky or unique or super silly to go out on?
No, I'm really thirsty. I just want to go and leave.
Does anyone want to pay me three times what I paid for these chai colas, please?
Yeah.
It's a bargain.
Never used, never opened.
Yeah, I mean, when I open, you can have this one too if you want. You can use my DNA to create any super soldiers you want if that's your end goal. Whatever, just pay me back. This Chai Cola sucks. I mean, it's amazing. Wink, wink. Please pay me. Goodbye, everybody.